Thank you. Welcome, everyone. March 5th board meeting, and we are going to report out our closed session items. We had two student expulsion matters and a discussion with staff regarding anticipated litigation and a conference with labor negotiators, Ray, an unrepresented employee. And I think it's later in the agenda where we vote on the actual, thank you, Mrs. Holmes, as always. Consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Yes. All right, let's plow on. Let's see. Okay. I've already announced the closed session items. We didn't take action on the other ones, just the student discipline matters. And now we'll move on to item 4.02, a decision on stipulated student expulsions. There's two of them, so I'll entertain a motion regarding student A.
I would move to accept the recommendation with regard to student A.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mrs. Shepherd, second by Mr. Unger, regarding the expulsion of student A. Any discussion by board members? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye. Opposed? Passes 6-0. And
Mr. Moore?
Yes, ma'am.
I have to abstain from both expulsions because
that's where you weren't
was
present.
Late.
Okay. So okay. We have
five ayes
and one abstention. Thank you, Mrs. Roger, for reminding me of that. And then I'll move approval of the recommendation for expulsion for student B.
I'll second.
Okay. Motion by the chair, second by Mrs. Sheffer. Any board discussion? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye. Opposed? Abstain? One. Okay. 5-0 and one. And approval of the minutes. I think we only have one set from the February 19th meeting. Anybody have any, anybody make a motion initially?
I'll move approval of the minutes of February 19th.
I would second that, but I do have a correction. Okay. I'm sorry, Mrs. Holmes, I didn't get it to you earlier.
Go ahead, Chris.
I understand that in the minutes we refer to it as Sierra Vista Hospital. I've been told it's actually Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center. So I think they would appreciate that, and thank you. Sorry I didn't get that to you earlier.
Okay. Any other changes or additions? Okay. I'll accept the changes that Mr. Unger has brought up in my motion, and I assume Mrs. Sheffer is okay with that, too?
Okay.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I was hung up on the other one. So your motion to approve the minutes, and who was the second?
Mr. Unger with the clear.
Oh, okay, good. So any further discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 6-0. Now, moving on. We have no student representatives tonight. I'm sure they are off doing important student stuff. But that brings us more quickly to perhaps one of the most favorite events of the year, hosted, I assume, by Terry Main and Dr. Prater, and looking forward to it.
Am I on?
I was, just greeting a new arrival. Once again, it's a pleasure to be here before the board to present the Spring 2013 CHEECH Grant Awards. This time out, we're awarding $12,478.03 to a number of very, very fine teachers in our school district over a wide variety of activities. And in response to, I think, Chris's question at the last board meeting about how much money Teach had actually donated to the district in the form of grants for teachers, that total now stands at $199,846, and hopefully growing. So, as usual, we're going to have the teachers who are here tonight to receive their awards come up and tell you about the wonderful things that they're doing and explain their grants to you. Terry?
Hello, my name is Terry Wright, and I'm the library tech at Baywood Elementary. And I'm just thrilled to have received a $1,000 grant from the Teach Endowment for Children to bring an author to our school. Her name's Alexis O'Neill. She's written The Recess Queen and a number of other delightful picture books. But more importantly, she's a great presenter. She's a former teacher, and writers aren't always great presenters, so I'm thrilled about that. I heard it through the grapevine. She's really fantastic. So she's going to do two assemblies, for one for primary, one for upper grades, and then come, you know, and she brings props and music, and the kids write the story together with her help. And then she'll be doing two classroom workshops, writing workshops, and come back for the evening for our family read aloud night and do book signing and just tell her own story, which is always makes such a powerful impact on kids, I think. Just to think that she was once little and like me, and maybe she got made fun of at school or wasn't a great student, but, you know, she became a published author. So thank you, Terry Main, and thank you to the Teach Society that we wouldn't have been able to bring her. So I'm thrilled. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Danielle Elsie, and I'm a first grade teacher over at Pacheco. It's nice to see you tonight. And our first grade team just really wants to thank the Teach Foundation for this grant of $750. We're doing a farm-to-table field trip to Avila Valley Barn. So the four first grade classrooms with this grant, we were able to cover expenses in order to take all four classes to Avila in the spring. What Elizabeth Abisher, who's our part-time reading instructor, has done in her own time this year is she has also become a garden instructor. So we have a small plot that she has, you know, helped maintain as a garden this year. And in our second language classes at Pacheco, she has been taking students for lessons and centers that are really hands-on and full of rich language all year, basically since the fall. And so we had this great idea to end it in this, you know, final giant, wonderful, fantastic, hands-on field trip to Avila Valley Barn. We're hoping to pick berries, depending on the weather, and basically just experience what they do as a farm, how it comes back to our table, and wrap up all that we've learned in our garden time. So thank you so much for this opportunity. We're so excited. We haven't told the students yet, but they're going to be thrilled. So, and really, also, I just want to say that for many of the students of, you know, the population of our students just don't have these opportunities all the time. We take Avila Valley Barn for granted, it's 7 miles away, but from SLO, but at the same time, many of them have probably never been there. So this is going to be a wonderful end to our unit. So thanks again, and thanks, Terry.
Good evening. My name is Monica Garcia, and I'm the brand new preschool teacher at Pacheco. And I want to say thank you to the Teach Foundation. Our grant was Learn by Doing, and it's our way of connecting the new Common Core math standards with preschool. And so the money will be used to purchase a lot of brand new math manipulatives, working on the 10 frame, giving the kids exposure for the next years to come. And so that's how we'll be using it. This class that we have currently will be able to experience a lot of these materials, but I hope that they will last for many years. And as our district is working on linking much more of our instruction with the Common Core, I definitely think that this will be a plus for many years to come. So thank you on behalf of all the Pacheco preschoolers, their families, and all the future students that will be using these materials. Thank you.
Good evening. Colleen Wall, teach choir here at Loams and at Morro Bay High. There are so many things that go into, and this will actually affect the band program as well, not just me and the parents that work together with the program for the choir. But there are so many things that go into keeping a program running efficiently that are outside of classroom time, and it just feels like more and more stuff gets eaten up from actually focusing on instruction. And so over the summer came across a wonderful web service called Charms Office Assistant, and it is a service that will help streamline our inventory control, music library, communication with parents through the booster organizations, and it will go out to all media with a click of a button. We can make our own broad calls and just streamline so much of what we spend a lot of time doing in different branches and different lines of effort, and just streamline it all, make it easier, especially students when they transfer from this program to that one. We just move them over, you know, and we keep track of everything. So it's going to be a wonderful service, and the added great part is that students can record themselves at home and email it to us so they can practice at home or record something that they've written and send it to us. It's going to be a great interactive tool as well. So we're super excited. Thank you very much.
I'm Charles Pearson from Laguna Middle School. Teach Foundation granted us $642 to purchase small engines for the industrial arts program. The eighth graders will have the opportunity to take apart a working engine, name the parts, put it back together, and have it work again before they get a grade. It has been a lot of fun in the past, and students seem to enjoy taking things apart and making them work again. So I thank you and thank the Teach Grant Foundation.
Hi, good evening. I'm Anne-Marie Stellman, and I'm a science teacher here at Los Osos Middle School. And we received the maximum award from Teach Foundation, $1,000, so we can take a field trip for 7th grade, which is a big undertaking. So thank you to the Teach Foundation. We're going to Morro Bay's Natural History Museum and the Salt Marsh, and this will be sort of a culminating event for our students, connecting all of our dune restoration that we've been doing here on campus with the biology they've been learning in the classroom, and taking them out so that they can see how their learning connects to this environment, both the state park and the estuary, and also the watershed, and putting all of those parts, all of the parts of the system together. And then hopefully they'll be inspired to continue to investigate our local environment in high school and beyond. So thanks for letting us try again. Last time we got this grant, I just wanted to let you know we did 4 different field trips, and we took the whole group on one day, and we came back and we did a sharing of technology, and it was sort of an extravaganza. This time we're paring it down. We are just doing one field trip per day, and we're splitting the groups into 2 days, and we had busing issues, so you helped us solve that problem. And our pilot program has resulted in Cal Poly Teacher Education field trip program that they're developing, and our field trips have been used by the 6th grade teachers around here. So it's been working. We'll keep working on it. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Daniel Jude. I'm special ed teacher at Morro Bay High School. The Teach Grant awarded me $1,000. I'll be starting a classroom garden area. I was lucky enough to have a classroom that opens out to a grass field, so the first step is to put in some gardens, not only as an extension for hands-on biology lessons, but with my students, it's really important. Gives them an opportunity to learn responsibility and other skills that are going to carry on into life. This is the first step towards developing this whole area. And what I have in mind is eventually being able to work on landscaping skills and keep some of my students progressing towards careers after high school. I'm also here to accept on behalf of Kathy Bueller, our vice principal, for her Morro Bay Pirate Plaza. This gives students in need the opportunity to get supplies, clothing, sundries, things that they need at no cost to them. It also helps with my students and gives them workability opportunities, where I give them the opportunity to go work in there and help her organize and keep the plaza running. So, again, thank you.
My name is Kate Stevens. I am teaching at SLO High School. I teach theater and history, and I'm going to be using the TEACH grant of $735 to purchase a curtain for the back of our theater. The students have been performing there for years with a sheer black curtain that, from the knees down, when someone walks backstage, you can see them. So we are going to put in a solid curtain that will be able to be used for lighting, and students will be benefiting from that all the time, but we have performance on Friday. We have As You Like It opening next week, and auditions for Into the Woods are tomorrow. So there will be students in there enjoying the productions as well as participating in them thanks to that grant. So thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Debbie Vandenberg, and I'm a speech-language pathologist working with the moderate to severe classes from preschool all the way through sixth grade. But all of us speech-language people who work with some of these very severe kiddos, over half of our caseloads, they have no verbal communication. So we work with pictures, and we have that low-tech level of communication. We work with some pre-recorded devices, and then if you're very fortunate enough, you can have a very, very sophisticated device that does something like this.
Thank you.
So, thank you. But this TEACH grant is going for sort of that middle-of-the-road application now that we have iPads, some of us. There is some very nice software that is nothing like this level of sophistication, but it's more than adequate for some of the kiddos who haven't had that kind of technology before. So it's that middle of the road. They'll be able to generate sentences and have a good core vocabulary that doesn't necessarily require us running around with pictures. So this is something that can be developed from preschool, take these kids through middle school and high school. So on behalf of the kids and the parents that we work with, to have alternatives for communication. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Amy Burris, and I am a teacher here at Los Osos Middle School, and the TEACH Foundation has honored us by giving us a $425 grant for speed stackers, and we have a little demonstration for you over here about what speed stackers is and how we're going to be using it at Los Osos Middle School.
Hi, my name is Abby Burris, and I'm going to be showing you speed stacks. Speed stacks is basically stacking cups and then putting them back in their original formation. There are different patterns or cycles. I will be doing the mega cycle, which goes from 3-6-3 to 6-6 to 3-3-3-3 to 1-10-1.
.925 seconds. I don't think I could do that, no matter how hard I tried. Well, anyway, you've seen some very diverse and very, very, very creative ideas presented by the teachers tonight. So they're really using our grant monies, we think, in wonderful, wonderful ways to enhance education in the community. Along with what you've heard here tonight, we've also given some more grants to Pacheco for books. You can never have enough books in the classrooms. We are also helping Pacific Beach High School bring in an art teacher We're funding Deaf Awareness Day at Disneyland for the Slow High American Sign Language class, and that's just to name a few. So once again, we look forward to continuing to do good work by supporting the wonderful teachers we have, and I'd like to give them all a round of applause again. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. And the board wants to thank the Teach Foundation, which makes this possible. And it's such a delight to hear the creative use of this money by our teachers. And every year, this year was particularly amazing. and we just appreciate it so much. And please thank all the supporters and board members of the Teach Foundation, but particularly Terry.
We will. But thanks for letting us come. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Mr. Moss,
yes, please.
I just want to say one quick thing. It does feel a little awkward to me when the teachers are coming up and explaining and they're looking at us and it's as though they're thanking us. And we're appreciative just as they're appreciative of what they're receiving from the Teach Foundation, which is a community-funded foundation to support education in San Luis Coastal. These are not gifts from us, but rather from the community. And
yes, if we were to go back, I mean, it's one of those things, it's hard to, now that we've been doing this for about 12 years, you realize there are people who've never heard of us before, and we actually are a nonprofit, community-based educational foundation that raises money to give back to schools in our area in the form of grants to teachers. So thanks for letting me point that out again.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you
night.
For all your hard work.
Thanks,
Terry.
Thank you. Next, we are coming up on public comment. This is public comment on items that are not on the agenda or for people who may find it more convenient to speak now than wait for a later item on the agenda. And do we have requests, Jim?
Yes, we have three requests. We have Andrea Devitt, Kathleen Benedict, and Kathy Bonnet, and you'll each have 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. My name's Andrea Devitt, and I'm a counselor at Cuesta College and a graduate of San Luis High School and the old San Luis Junior High and the old Pacheco. And I also have a master's in education and a master's in public policy. But I was lucky enough to study policy and not make it like all of you. Just looking at, and actually I have two kids. One is a freshman at Cuesta and graduated from San Luis High School, and my son's a junior at San Luis High. And just following the papers and some of the board meetings recently, I want to talk a little bit about the democratic process. And I think the democratic process can be messy and timely and hard and really difficult. And it seemed to just get a little hijacked and maybe not on purpose. And I read this story in the New York Times on Saturday. If I can pass this over and maybe to Kim. I want that to count against my 3 minutes. And it's just about online comments and negative online comments made about a story and how that really affects the reader and changed the reader's mind. And I know the Tribune as well as Cal Coast News allow online blogging where you don't have to put your name, unlike the New Times that doesn't allow any online blogging. And that article talks about how it does change the reader's minds when negative comments are made. And there are sometimes negative comments made like, oh, Walt Millar is blah, 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 blah. And then 49 people like that. And I think that's really difficult, and I understand that people want... Well, people are very passionate and caring about their kids, and I definitely understand that. And it is scary when they are worried about a program going away. But this shouldn't have happened the way that it happened, in my opinion. And again, I'm just seeing this from an outsider. So how do we bring this back? Because this is our community, and it just seemed to get very divisive. And I don't have an answer, and I know you don't have an answer right now, but I do believe in the democratic process. I absolutely believe there were no foregone conclusions going into this in studying TEACH and what to do about it. And I guess that's really all I have, and I just want to thank you for the service that you provide to this community. You have very hard decisions to make all the time, and I frankly am not even sure why you want to do it, because it is really, really hard work, and I think you guys got beat up somewhat unfairly on this. But again, I do want to thank you for what you do, and I hope that there will be this online blogging, it will stop, because I don't think it's fair to anybody.
Kathleen Benedict, and then Kathy Bonnet.
Hello. I'm a speech-language pathologist with the excellent San Luis Coastal Unified Special Education Department. I'm here to speak on behalf of the school counselors. I'm very worried and concerned about losing 8 elementary school counselors. I just came this weekend. I was lucky enough to attend a conference on executive functioning. Executive functioning is about managing oneself and one's resources in order to achieve a goal, that goal being perhaps accessing the general education curriculum. It's an umbrella term for the neurologically based skills involving mental control and self-regulation. That all takes place in the frontal lobe. The subcortex, which is the base of the brain, is affected by hunger, thirst, tiredness, and emotional stress. Unfortunately, when a person is in extreme, let's say, emotional stress, the subcortex takes over, and there is no executive functioning that occurs. My concern is that, honestly, the only specialists that we have in our school district that are specifically trained to assist a student in emotional distress are the counselors. And I'm here for the students. I was lucky enough to have my students, my children attend this school, and they didn't need the counselor. But I work next to the counselor, and she dramatically reduces emotional stress in students every single day. We're all here for the students. Please reconsider cutting these very, very essential specialists. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bonnet. I am the resource specialist at Baywood Elementary School. And I have a quote that I'd like to start off with. We believe that every child matters, regardless of their circumstances. Through the 3 R's of rigor, relevance, and relationship, students are provided valuable opportunities to become the very best they can be. Success for all requires many hands, multiple networks of thoughtful people, and an expectation that every child can achieve to their fullest. This is our conscious journey as a school district. I've always loved the phrase all means all. And I've thought of it as a special educator, you know, the kids that can't learn. Like Kathy was saying, there are children that come to school that are not able to access that rigor. They're in emotional distress. They need someone to help them get through the distress that they're in so they can learn, and they have the right for that. I think it's fair to say I've attended 90% of the SSTs at Baywood in the past 20 years. many, many, many times. We are dependent upon our school counselor to begin with the journey that these children need to take in order to have that rigor. I have some information from our counselor about some of the things that she does, and I hate reading to a crowd because I'd get really nervous, but if you bear with me, I'm going to try to summarize it a little bit. These are some of the things the school counselor does. Crisis intervention on a daily basis. Support of unidentified students who require additional support beyond the classroom teacher to access their learning. Counseling interventions such as individual and group counseling, consultation to staff and parents, and referrals to community agencies, which occur prior to SSTs and referrals to special ed. In many cases, these interventions, along with academic interventions, are critical in postponing or eliminating the need for special ed services. Identification and case management of 504 students. As you know, those are non-special ed students who require modifications and support because of the American Disability Act. Who's going to do that if the school counselors aren't there? School principal, I guess. School psychologists do not have the time, as you guys know. Providing expertise to sight and interpretation of social and emotional needs and conditions that impact our students. Our school counselor constantly is talking with the school staff, helping them understand these difficult and challenging students. Guess my time's up. I can email this to you if you like. I urge you to reconsider your decision to eliminate all of the elementary school counselors. At least go back to where the counseling program was 2 or 5 years ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. We have no further requests to speak at this portion of public comment, so we'll bring it back to the board. And we received, did you see someone?
I did.
Does someone want to speak?
She told me she did.
Oh, come on.
I came to make a public comment. My name is Linda Quesenberry, and I'm a youth family advocate for Transitions Mental Health Association. And I've heard the wonderful things that the people have said about the counselors, and I just wanted to add, I work with counselors in San Luis Obispo and on the coast. I work very closely with them. And I get the referrals from the counselors when they want me to help the parents and the families. And I've seen the difference that it makes for them being there at the schools one-on-one with the kids and also with the parents that they see every day. I come in as an advocate, so I give the other resources for them, and I help the parents navigate the system. That's something that it's really hard for a counselor to do, you know, besides everything else. And just the dedication, the compassion, and the trust that they have with the families is really, really important. And taking it away from a day-to-day basis would make it really difficult for all the families in the schools. And I just want to say praises for, you know, I could say names, but it's like I love to work with Rose and Sue and Carol, Maribel, Carla, Heidi, Apol, all the counselors that I've worked with in the district, and I just wanted to sing their praises because they are so dedicated. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Okay. Anyone else want to speak? Okay. We'll bring it back to correspondence. The board received correspondence regarding a letter from the Julian Crocker, the County Office of Education Supervisor, acknowledging our first interim report. We received numerous pieces of correspondence regarding the notification of potential layoffs for certain employees, and we received additional correspondence regarding the Teach Bishop's Peak space issue. Let's see. We'll move on to state budget update from Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Board. Tonight in the state budget update, I'd like to talk about three different items. Sequestration. I knew I'd mess that up. The Legislative Analyst's Office has also issued an opinion and a letter about some issues that are going to affect us and how we got to where we're at with our budget platform that we're going to launch our budget discussions on. First, sequestration. And what has happened is you're all aware that the federal government hasn't been able to halt the cuts that were automatically imposed by legislation they passed about a year ago. And one of our tasks is to estimate the impact of that. What? I'm pointing the red thing. I know what I'm doing.
Doing the laser.
Most of the time. The first program up there, but I can't get the red thing up there. But anyway, Title I. And current entitlement is $673,000. The reduced entitlement is $618,000 estimated. We'll lose about $55,000. IDEA, special ed, 1.2, goes down to 1.1, lose about $100,000. IDEA special ed preschool 173 to 158 lose 14,000. The Carl Perkins lose 3,000. Title II is a Teacher Quality Act. That's about 20 grand. And limited English under Title III 9,000. Total cost of the federal sequestration is $204,000.
Well said. When can we expect these funds? Are they not going to arrive? Are they going to be clawed back? Or
yeah, they will not arrive.
Okay, so
in the next apportionments, it's this year.
So this 12-13 budget year.
Yes.
So okay,
there'll be impacts that we're going to have to mitigate. Once we know what the final pieces of the puzzle are going to be, then we'll bring it back to you about what the impact is going to be. But I did want to let you know what our estimated amount of it is, and we're just doing a straight 8.2%. It could be a little bit different because they have to cut a certain percentage, but it's only for 9 months, and so the calculation becomes complicated. Chris?
I think there's a couple of things I'd like to point out, and I just want to make sure everybody understands that I think, first of all, we should consider these ongoing cuts because it doesn't seem like there's any will from the feds or the Congress to do anything about the sequestration. The other thing that strikes me about this is that the bulk of this targets children that are at risk. Our Title I kids, our special ed kids, the Perkins grants, I believe those are CTE grants, are they not?
Correct.
Teacher quality, our limited English. So it's despicable. I'd like to just put that out there. And the other thing is, I was just wondering, Russell, if I could get a copy of this?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question also? So with these cuts, are these programs that are up there, are those federally mandated? Are we expected to perform at the same level?
We're going to continue the programs with the board's permission. We'll recommend a continuation because we're already engaged in them, delivery and programmatically. They're not mandated in the sense of a mandate for legislation. You qualify for these funds, and then you're given the money, and you follow the dictates of the program. Now, one of the things would be is that we'll have to judge the continuation into next year. We'll make budget adjustments for it, but in terms of 12-13, we've already employed the people. We've already laid out the consultant contracts and other things that we do inside those programs. So we'll continue to deliver that program as we have it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Walter, help me understand. There must be some qualifier. There must be some criteria that the federal government doles out this money. So is it the number of children? Is it based on ADA? Well, so based on children involved, and in, I'm assuming based in, involved on those in those programs.
Well, Title I is a low-income qualifier,
right.
So free and reduced has an impact, and that's you get funded on the number of qualifying students, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So, you know, special ed's a bit different. You get a base amount, and then it passes through the state's hands, and they pick a little bit off the top and then give you what's left over. There's no, you know. The same thing on Title II and III, though.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Okay. Next item. We have a second issue is a legislative analyst has issued a opinion, I guess, and it's a recommendation to the legislature. For those of you who may not be familiar, the Legislative Analyst Office is a bipartisan group that presents advice and information to legislators so that they can base their decisions on some nonpartisan kind of information. The recommendation from the LAO to the legislature is that when they start to consider language to implement Governor Brown's budget recommendations that were issued on January 15th, one of the premier paragraphs of that recommendation that affects us as a basic aid district, as a community funded district, is that they recommend that the state not only take the fair share of pain that we're currently paying, but take all state monies that the state currently gives us. We receive approximately $7 million, $8 million from the state of California. Our fair share of pain is $4.5 million, leaving us with about $2.5 million that we would expect to get under Governor Brown's recommendations of the budget in 13-14. The LAO says, take it all. That's very problematic, and it has a great concern for us because the LAO is a nonpartisan group, and legislators tend to put a lot of weight in their recommendations. As a little bit of background, the governor has already proposed to turn the state's removal of our $4.5 million, known as the fair share of pain for community-funded schools, and take it from our categorical funds as a permanent ongoing cut. Prior to January 15th, this was a totally unexpected move on the governor's part. In addition, we had anticipated that the state would return the $11 million they had stolen from it, I mean, they had taken from us in the prior 3 years. This is not going to happen at this point. We're going to lose our $11 million, and we're going to have an ongoing at least $4.5 million cut. In 1993 and 2003, the state had some economic difficulties, and they imposed what was known at the time as a deficit reduction on revenue limit districts. They took money. At the end of their economic troubles, they returned that money, and they returned the deficit factor. They turned it back into the ongoing revenue limit that districts expected to receive. They implemented these types of takeaways, but then when the financial condition improved, they paid them back. Not so this time. We will have about $2.5 million of state money left coming to us after the fair share of pain is made permanent. And as I said, the LAO is recommending that they take all of that also. Time will tell. Our budget, this impacts our budget discussions in the sense that what we're going to assume for the purposes of our discussions is that the state is going to take the $4.5 million, but not the $2.5 million. If, in fact, some legislation is passed in the upcoming months that turns that upside down, then we'll have to react accordingly. But at this time, what I want to propose as our base for ongoing budget discussions is that we implement decisions based on what we know as exists today. Not what we're speculating about, not what we're unsure about, but what we actually know, incentive that we gave to teachers last year to that they took advantage of. And it's $1.1 million that's coming out of Fund 20 and transferred into the general fund to pay for the cost of those retiree benefits. So that reduces our deficit from 5.5 to $4.3 million. Now, we've been talking about a $6 million deficit. I'm talking about a $4.5 million deficit now. And the reason is there's been a new development out of Proposition 30. It's a little bit controversial in terms of whether we should be counting on this, but essentially what it is, it's a part of the proposition that's called the Educational Protection Act, the EPA. And in essence, what it says is that there's $200 per ADA that's available to districts as a minimum funding from this proposition. The reality is revenue limit districts probably don't get to take advantage of this because they're already getting state money, so the $200 minimum from the state doesn't come into play. But districts that are revenue limit very close to becoming basic aid or basic aid districts that don't receive any of this other monies would qualify for the $200. Now, School Services is here tonight to talk about some other issues. They've had an opportunity to examine this issue, and they say, book the revenue, but don't count on spending the money yet, because it only takes one sentence in legislation to wipe that out, and that's a potential. But, on the other hand, our county office recommends, actually states, you're getting the money. Take it, put it in your second interim, which is what is going to come in front of you next week. Count on getting it. I've made the decision at this point that in our budget discussions, we can adjust our deficit number from $6 million to $4.5 million. Okay? That's a really important step. I'm going in this direction for two reasons, one of which is we can always reverse the number from 4.5 to 6 if legislation appears that wipes out the $200 per ADA. And, well, I'm going to go with what the county says because I do know it's in legislation. It's what we can count on at the moment. If they change it, we're just going to have to be fast on our feet and change accordingly. But right now, it's part of legislation.
And it's for next fiscal year?
It's actually for this fiscal year and for the next 7 years.
And so it's essentially what basic aid used to be, the minimum 190 or...
It's a different, yes. Yeah. It would be the same idea. When we're basic aid, you get $120 minimum. Well, out of this act, out of this proposition, you get $200 minimum funding across the board. Most other districts are getting their money in a revenue limit stream somehow their way. Basic aids have been, they don't get any kind of money out of Prop 30 per se except for this.
Is the equity argument being made that since we're not going to get our fair share of pain back, that this is what should happen with the Prop 30 money? It's just
different
people are parsing the statutes.
It's just a different conversation. I'm not even sure they intended it to be this way, and that's why I think that School Services has taken the position that they have, that it isn't thought out that basic aid should have received this. It just is an implementation of the language that happens to exist. Will they change the language? I don't know.
Mark, did you?
Excuse me, one second.
It's not going to be that hard a question, Russell.
I'll wait.
Or it might be.
This always makes me nervous.
I'm just hearing a slight disconnect, and I just want to... So the LAO is saying, basically, take the money away from...
Yes.
Okay. And what I'm hearing you say is there's actually going to be an increase in a portion...
There's two different statements
totally
there.
Okay.
One topic is, you know, don't let basic aid districts have any of the state money, take it all. And then we have Prop 30, which gives us $200 per. The LAO, as far as I can tell on their statements, haven't weighed into that issue yet.
Okay. And in my understanding, if I can just check, the Prop 30 money if the legislators can play with that to a certain extent with trailer bills.
They can do a lot of stuff, yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
It takes one sentence, as somebody tonight told me, to wipe it all out. So we'll see what happens. Okay, so Kim, can you turn to the next one, please? Elected here unless they were vacant positions that we did not fill. Next one, please, Kim. These are, when we confront our budget issue, we're going to be looking at different departments and different areas that we can reduce our expenditures in. And listed up there are various programs and the total expenditure budgeted this year for those programs. So top left, counseling 2.4, high school campus supervisor 300,000, supervision, not supervisor, I'm sorry, supervision. And you can read those, and those are the areas that we would look at for potential budget reductions when we go into constructing the budget for 2013-14.
And just to be clear, even though we've had to act on some notification issues, none of these decisions have been made yet.
No. We have.
Getting a lot of emails where people seem to believe that notification action.
Thank you.
Was the equivalent of having made decisions to.
It's a very important point and a distinction to be made. We are acting in accordance with the law. The law has basic timelines and rules that we must follow. Even though we are not prepared to commit to a certain act, we have to plan to commit to that act by the law. What you have done in adopting the resolution for reduction in force is to plan to act on that particular issue at some point prior to May 15th, I believe. So right now, you have adhered to the law that keeps your options open. Nobody has had a permanent layoff notice. Nobody has been told not to come back next year. There are no permanent decisions in what your act has taken. So what we are going to be doing over the next 2 months, 2.5 months, is talking about all of these various issues and putting together a package of cuts that I am going to strongly recommend results in a balanced budget. It gets a little bit ahead of myself here, but because we have been using $11 million of our reserves for the last 3 years to bridge the fair share of paying issues and not do cuts into programs and not do cuts into people, we now are confronted with the reality that these $11 million aren't coming back to us and are going to continue each and every year to the tune of at least $4.5 million. We must stop spending our reserves and balance our budget, or else we are going to run out of money in a very short order. And I'll show you that in maybe not tonight, but in the next board meeting for sure. Funding levels for programs. Next one, Kim. Here's a depiction of what I'm talking about. This is, you don't really have to pay attention to the total numbers. Just look at the graph. The year 10-11, we had a surplus. And then in 11-12, we have a deficit. It's not like it happened to us without knowledge. We knew what we were doing. We decided not to impact our spending, but to use our reserves, which we had a lot of money, sufficient to be able to do this. And we did it in 4 years. That's a painful graph. Next one, Kim. This one is our ending balance. And you will see that in those years that we used our reserves, our ending balance reduced itself. Next one, Kim, please. Our biggest issue, because we didn't make cuts and our revenues went down, is that 92% of our current year's budget goes to employee compensation in the form of salaries and benefits. And if you look at 10-11, the watershed year, it was 70. I can't see that far. What does it say? Thank you. 79%. And now it's up to 92. And continuing to grow as salaries will and revenues don't, that percentage becomes unmanageable. The percentage is unmanageable as it exists. You know, we need to reduce that percentage to 84%. Anything greater than 84%, you need to start questioning what's going on. So this is the big issue for us in our budget issues. We're people rich, and we are now suffering with withdrawals of revenues, reduction of revenues. Next one, Kim. This is the fair share of pain in a dollar amount. Take away the graph just so you can see the dollars. And if you look at 10-11, it starts at the bottom and goes up in terms of current year. And in 07, be able to make payroll. That's how basic that problem is.
So does this mean we're going to need to do trans for those 2 months?
Yeah, not trans. We're going to be transferring money from other funds as a temporary loan between the funds. But it carries with it the provision that we have to pay it back by the end of the year. But fortunately, April's money comes in. The point is, our cash has been diminished to the point where our receipt of revenue or a non-receipt of revenue in months between December and April become magnified as terms of how little cash we have to manage our issues. The big problem with basic aid districts is its cash flow and how to manage that. We've always been fine because our cushion between basic aid and revenue limit has been sufficient, $20 million, in order to bridge through those months. This time, not so. We have a negative, we have an overdrawn checkbook, if you will, in those particular 2 months. We'll be okay, but it has never happened before. Next one, Kim. So I'd like to bring you back to what is going to be your second interim for the general fund that you'll be asked to approve next board meeting. And as I've told you, the deficit is down to $4.3 million. It is a significant issue for us, one that we can no longer ignore. And if we don't fix the problem, it will overcome us in a short period of time, 2 years. The issue of not reducing our expenditures will result in a lack of money within 2 years. We will become in a qualified or negative situation for our financial condition.
And so when you say fix the problem, you're saying to make the cuts necessary this year and the budget process that removes the structural deficit that we've been experiencing for a number of years.
Absolutely.
Now, and I did notice in the financial comparative report, there's a reference to deficit spending, but I think it's important that people know that we didn't set about to deficit spend. We had money withdrawn from our revenues that put us into the decision where we either had to deficit spend and backfill, or is that
yeah, but fair? Let me be a little more clear about it.
Okay.
It's almost a situation I owe you an apology, because my assumption was wrong, and the assumption was that we were going to experience the same kind of conditions when the state improved its economic condition as we had in the history of the past. And that turns out to be, unfortunately, not true. What we did was we diminished our reserves by $11 million over the last 3 years. And we did that knowingly. I mean, we weren't oblivious to what the issue was. We were deficit spending, but we did have $25 million in the bank. We didn't want to affect people's lives if we could help it. We didn't want to cut high-performing, valuable programs unless we have to. And I'm here to tell you, we now have to, that we have no choices left, that you're going to have a very tough decision on what types of expenditures are going to have to be reduced to the tune of, tonight, $4.3 million, I'm sorry. It could change. I don't think it's going to get any better than that. unless we find, you know, a pot full of money coming our way, maybe the Cayucas decision, maybe some other issue would spring up. But I think you're just grasping for straws when you start that. I think what you guys have to understand is that what we achieved last year through compromise and the actual non-action of cutting expenditures isn't an option for this coming year. 13-14 is going to be painful for the district, for employees, and especially for you guys on the board. It's not to be overlooked about what the impact and what the exposure to pain that you guys have to go through, as you already are having people writing you about the effect on their lives. But as an organization, we've done everything we could in order to put off this particular moment. You're going to be able to second guess and say, maybe we should have taken incrementally every year for the last 3 years. Maybe we should have done this. We didn't. That's okay. That's the reality. But now we have to. So the key here is that this is a second interim coming up, and it's going to be the basis for our budget discussions. And I have an item right of resources to be able to bridge through anymore. You have to take swift, decisive action in order to maintain our fiscal solvency into the future. I'm ready for questions on that issue, if you have any.
Let me go to give the public an opportunity to comment on this issue, if there is anyone. Okay, seeing no one, did you want to go ahead and do your next presentation on the budget, district budget process update?
Sure. In this particular item, what I wanted to set up for the board and interact with the board and have changes from the board if you so desire is the budget process that we've designed and a timeline attached to it. So what we've already done in the month of February was Mr. Robinette has gone out and visited all of the school sites to speak of issues with staff. And you're familiar with his report and how he had prepared that and how he delivered that. And he has had an opportunity to interact with each and every school staff throughout the district. On March 1st, we established, in my name, believe it or not, a blog. Okay. Also, I have a Twitter account. What are you laughing for? And we did this in order to allow... Actually, my secretary is doing it, but that's okay. To allow the community staff and students to weigh in, what we've done is send out an email to all of the staff and ask them to advertise the existence of the blog, the existence of the Twitter, and to please have people weigh in on their interests. It's our attempt to use the social media and internet for reaching out to all kinds of different people. On March 8th, we're currently constructing a formal survey that we'll put out on one of the survey machines, the survey software that's available, with structured questions for a broad section of staff and community to talk about. We hope there to get comments back that people might not want to do in the blog or the Twitter. It'll be anonymous, it'll be general, but it'll be structured with specific questions that they'll answer on a range of 1 to 5 and see what happens on that piece. Between yesterday and March 31st, and actually we only have something going through March 20th, spring break happens in there, we're meeting with specific interest groups, the Ed Tech Committee, Special Ed, librarians, clerks, counselors, as affected employees, the DLAC committee, PTA, SEIU, CSEA representatives, and athletics. So we want to talk to all components of our district that want to talk to us. Now, there's one significant group that's missing. What we asked was for the teachers to come to the table and talk. And what they have said to us is they're not interested at this time. So they're not on the list. I just wanted you to know we have reached out to them. They have declined to participate. On the first week of April, the student I mean, I'm sorry, the Superintendent's Budget Process Committee, which was in existence last year, we're going to call them back again. And what's going to end up being done with that group is all of the other groups are going to feed their recommendations to this group. This group is going to distill them, value them, prioritize them, and decide then, sometime before April 7th, a recommendation to the superintendent of the budget reductions and direction that we should be taking. We've made this a very tight timeline in the sense of time so that we can end up with something before the board with enough time to be able to either act quickly or take additional testimony and consideration of whatever it is the board feels comfortable doing. In recognition of what the magnitude we're asking you to do, we're trying to give you enough time, if it's necessary, for that to happen in a very measured and organized way. So sometime around April 7th, and the first board meeting in April is April 9th, so we would hope that the superintendent has a recommendation that has enough time to present to you his recommendations by that first meeting in April. That'll give you at least three meetings and up to five if you want to take to discuss this issue. What we would recommend is that the board, and what we will do, is keep the board informed all along, keep you up to date, advise you of the progress or lack thereof, and have you in a position, if you're comfortable, to make a decision early in April. And just might be able to achieve that. The problem with the packaged canned survey machines, they don't lend themselves to these interactive processes.
Yeah, I'm not sure that a blog is exactly what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about the actual, this is the figure, if you remove this program, you get $500,000 worth of cuts. You still have $3.8 million worth of cuts you have to make. Where are the rest of those cuts going to come from? Here are some other options, and how do you get to that point, and what do you actually value?
Okay. Let me work on that. It's an interesting process, right. And I don't know of any software that exists that would allow me to do it.
I don't know, but I know that there are other organizations that have done it, and I think it would be very instructive.
Okay.
Something the board could use and something the community could use as well.
Let me look into it. Mr. Buckman.
Maryland. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Walter. I apologize.
I'd like to understand what's being proposed here is the meetings with all of these interest groups, if you will, beginning of March, ending the 19th of March, and then the first week of April, this budget committee, are they going to be getting the documents from whatever happened when DLAC was met with and whatever happened when athletics was met with? They're going to get all that information, and they have 1 week in which to synthesize it all and come and prepare a recommendation for presentation to Dr. Prater?
Yes.
That's a really short timeline.
It is.
They're going to have to meet every day that week, probably.
I am planning on working many evenings through the month of March in order to achieve this. And then with the committee, it's a dedicated committee. They're experienced. They did this last year. I think they'll grasp the issues. I recognize it's very fast. We will be flexible with our time. If we're not getting anywhere, if something happens, then we have to advance it. But remember, we're starting in April. And so it's not like we're up against the deadline. We're still 2 months away. So we have room to be flexible.
What are we anticipating, if anything? What do you hear with your ear to the ground about the May revise?
Nothing yet. Nothing. Okay, all we
so
know.
We just have to move forward with what's known now.
Yeah.
Period.
And the reason probably we're not hearing much about the May revise is legislation hasn't been crafted or acted upon to reflect what the governor's budget proposal has been so far. Remember, this is March, just the 1st of March. He let his governor's proposal out on January 15th. And so right now it's been percolating in Sacramento. It's been talked about. There's the pros and the cons about the local control funding formula, how that's going to impact urban districts, rural districts. people have a lot different perspective than perhaps we do. Our part's just a small little piece. But this local control funding formula, guys, is huge in a major way. And I'll give you an example. I did the rollout of the 7 years. Actually, Julie did it, but I'll take credit for it right now. Julie did it, and what she did was she projected what a local control funding formula looks like for us over the 7 years of its life. If you take our position 2 years ago, we were $21 million into basic aid, above our revenue limit. Okay? Significant. In 7 years from now, the way the local control funding formula is thought to work, we will be $1 million into basic aid. And it's not because we're losing basic aid. It's because the local control funding formula is pushing up against our local property tax income. That's significant. That's huge. So what we're dealing with is a changing world, but even more than us, the revenue limit districts out there are monopolizing the discussion right now to try and figure out what the local control funding formula does to them. That's what's happening in Sacramento, okay, more than our particular issues.
Okay, I'm curious, and I appreciate Mark for letting me ask this question. So if we're only $1 million above what our revenue limit is, that means there will be revenue limit school districts in this county that will be a lot richer than we are. I know that the local control formula addresses some of the poorer districts, Shandon, San Miguel, but I also know that were we a revenue limit district, I think we're 10th out of 11, or are we 9th out of 10? So that puts us back in that lower quartile, really, of school districts in San Luis Obispo County, and we're still a basic aid school district.
Actually,
is that not true?
You're going to have to forget about what happens in the revenue limit formula.
I can't remember the numbers, Russell.
Our revenue limit at that time, which was 2 years ago, was 6,300 or 6,800. 6,300 was our revenue limit. But today, that revenue limit would be 5,100 because of the shortfall that the state takes from districts.
And about $4,000 less than we have at our disposal now.
Yeah.
So it'd be huge.
And but remember, revenue limit goes away. I mean, the old days, if this is enacted as it's currently proposed, and that's a big if, because there are very powerful rural districts that don't like this because their funding suffers. And there are very powerful urban districts, guess which one, is highly in favor of this. And so it's going to be a battle. And I don't know if it's a compromise situation or if it's just straight ahead.
And my second point would be to support Chris's, and I think we both talked to this. If people go to the California Budget Project, to their website, and it's probably californiacbp.org, but they actually have a pie chart, and you can actually plug in numbers, and the pie chart actually changes. It's very powerful, and I'd really like us to be able to have that, because it will drive people to our website. It will make them read blogs, because if they're going to be able to do it themselves, otherwise getting them to go look at numbers and read might be difficult. But if there's a Prop 38, use this as well. You could plug in your school district, name of your school, and you could automatically see what Prop 38
sure.
would have given you. So I'm going to support Chris entirely.
That's fine. I'll do the best I can with it. Yeah, I don't know anything about it, but I'll look into it and see what I can make happen. That's for sure. Okay. Now, just in closing, I would ask that Maureen Evans, when she comes up, that if I've made any misstatements, that she corrects me. It'll be fine. I won't be offended. I would invite them, because much of what we know is speculative. And Maureen works for a firm that spends a lot of their time every day talking to legislators about this issue. So she's far, far more informed than I'll ever be. So I wish she can help me correct any errors and misimpressions.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any member of the public like to comment on this item? Come on up, Jim.
Jim Nett. I'm on the board of the SLCTA, and I wanted to put some information in Russell's ear that maybe he wasn't aware of, but I was just made aware at a meeting tonight of this offer to send six teachers to meet with you. President Paul Orton said we were to call Mandy Dawson and arrange that date, and in no way do I know that we have declined, because we are very, very interested in this budget process and want to have a very clear voice. Excellent. So we plan to participate with you, and I wanted to get that corrected in the record.
Excellent.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, now we will move on to update by Dr. Pruitt on the STEAM program right here in good old Loams.
Yes, welcome to Los Osos Middle School, everybody. Good evening, Superintendent Frater, Assistant Superintendents Miller and Robinette, and members of the school board tonight. Innovation is not teaching students to simply consume technology, but to create technology. The STEAM program here at Los Osos Middle School views coding skills as a critical component to our 21st century curriculum, and will be a major component to our spring professional development with all of our teachers, grades 6 through 8. Coding is critical thinking, the incorporation of technology, math, the arts, engineering, and science. Tonight we're going to show you a quick video. And I wanted to thank my special guest tonight, Simon Jansen, who's patiently waited to help me out. So thank you to Simon, and I'll introduce him in just a moment, as well as his dad as well. So, again, enjoy the video and coding.
I was 13 when I first got access to a computer.
My parents bought me a Macintosh in 1984 when I was 8 years old.
I was in sixth grade.
I learned to code in college.
Freshman year, first semester, intro to computer science.
I wrote a program to play tic-tac-toe.
I think it was pretty humble beginnings. I think the first program I wrote asked things like, what's your favorite color? Or how old are you?
I first learned how to make a green circle and a red square appear on the screen.
The first time I...
You need to be determined.
Addition, subtraction, that's about it.
You should probably know your multiplication tables.
You don't have to be a genius to code. Do you have to be a genius to read?
Even if you want to become a race car driver or play baseball or build a house. All of these things have been turned upside down by software.
What it is, you know, computers are everywhere. You want to work in agriculture? Do you want to work in entertainment? Do you want to work in manufacturing? You know, it's just all over.
Here we are, 2013. We all depend on technology to communicate, to bank, information, and none of us know how to read and write code.
When I was in school, I was in this after-school group called the WizKids, and when people found out, they laughed at me and, you know, all these things. And I'm like, man, I don't care. I think it's cool, and, you know, I'm learning a lot, and some of my friends have jobs.
Our policy is literally to hire as many talented engineers as we can find. The whole limit in the system is just that there just aren't enough people who are trained and have these skills today.
To get the very best people, we try to make the office as awesome as possible.
Free food.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Free laundry.
Snacks. Even places to play and video games and scooters. There's all these kind of interesting things around the office and places where people can play or relax or go to think or play music or be creative.
Whether you're trying to make a lot of money or whether you just want to change the world, computer programming is an incredibly empowering skill to learn.
I think if someone had told me that software is really about humanity, that it's really about helping people by using computer technology, it would have changed my outlook a lot earlier.
To be able to actually come up with an idea and then see it in your hands and then be able to press a button and have it be in millions of people's hands, I think we're the first generation in the world that's really ever had that kind of experience.
Just to think that, you can start something in your college dorm room and you can have a set of people who haven't built a big company before come together and build something that a billion people use as part of their daily lives is just crazy to think about, right? It's humbling and it's amazing.
The programmers of tomorrow are the wizards of the future. You know, you're going to look like you have magic powers compared to everybody else.
I think it's amazing. I think it's the closest thing we have to a superpower.
Great coders are today's rock stars. That's it.
So at this time, I hope you enjoyed the video. What I wanted in a portion of that video, some students were working in a program, and one of the things that we're going to focus on in our new STEAM program is to introduce sixth graders to a program called Scratch. And it is a basic program, a coding program. I'm going to introduce Mr. Simon Jansen, who is driving the computer over here to my left, who is a current eighth grader here at Los Osos Middle School, who used a free online coding program developed at MIT called Scratch to create a Loam's Pong game last night, since I asked him yesterday to help me out. And he's going to talk a little bit about this basic program, the code, which is on the left. Actually, the far left column are his options. I've played with this a little bit. My 10-year-old daughter did as well. The middle section of that is the actual code that he's using to develop, and the right, you'll see, is the product of his work. So I'm going to let Simon take over here and talk to you a little bit.
Hi. As he said, my name is Simon Jansen. I'm an eighth grader. Dr. Brewitt asked me to create something for tonight to show you all, and so I just made this. It's a simple Pong game that I made that sometimes is a little fast for me and sometimes doesn't work.
Because you don't have a joystick.
Yeah. There we go. So over here are all of the instructions that you can give to the sprites. Lots of different things here. So this is just a very simple one that I made yesterday. I'm going to show you something that my brother actually made a couple of years ago. He was a freshman when he made this. This is a science project for his class. And it's an interactive cell model that you can go to. When you click the corresponding letter key, then it highlights the different parts of the cell. You can see different cell types there. So this is all of the code for the plant cell. So when the C key is pressed, then it switches to different costume. This has lots of different costumes for each. For each situation that could come up. There are lots of different codes there. And then just an example of what you can do. This is a little bit more advanced My brother actually also made, he's now a junior in high school, just made a testicoil simulator that uses, that looks like a testicoil somewhat, so that, and as you can see over here, it's much more complex, lots more code. But really, it's just a combination of all of the different pieces. So, yeah. This you can use Scratch for fun. You can use it for school. It's a really neat way to learn how to program. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. I also want to recognize tonight, although I think he'd prefer me not, but he is due some recognition. One of the people that I've been able to collaborate with is a Cal Poly professor who's a computer science professor, and it's Simon's dad, Dr. David Jansen, who's here tonight. Can you stand up, please, Mr. Jansen? Thank you very much. The way that we've used Dr. Jansen, and I say that... used his support, is at every step of the way I've been trying to ask him about the rigor, the relevance about the ideas that we're having and the connection to the real skills that are required for, say, a student at Cal Poly. And so we've talked about the articulation of Scratch being a very entry-level coding type of program that our sixth graders potentially could handle. We've also talked about some more advanced coding programs leading up to the high school. We also, before we purchased our technology, asked Dr. Jansen to come in, and we loaded every possible coding program onto that device to make sure that it could handle the robustness of those programs and let him test drive a little bit for us before we made that commitment to that purchase. So I, again, just want to publicly thank him for taking the time to collaborate with me. And as I mentioned in our previous presentation, he's also collaborating with me around a potential Google grant in the spring to do some teacher training with us as well. So I want to thank him very much for that. In closing, again, thank you, Simon. Our team will be traveling to Dos Pueblos High School tomorrow to visit the engineering magnet program. We'll also be visiting Lompoc Valley Middle School to watch middle school STEAM electives in progress and in action. And so I hope you enjoyed our update tonight. Do you have any questions?
Yep, go ahead, Chris.
Of myself or Simon or Dr. Jansen?
Okay. Are we doing, what kind of outreach are we doing for fifth graders? Because I think that's really important. I know you've got the open house and the ribbon cutting. Are we doing more? Are you going to be able to get out into the schools and actually talk to the fifth graders, maybe get the counselors out there, help them think about electives, stuff like that? Because I think that's going to be real important as well.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to meet with district leadership just last week, Friday. Friday afternoon, where we were brainstorming about further options for outreach. My STEAM updates, I want to thank the elementary principal.
The local elementary schools have their open houses. Representatives from the middle school could be there to talk to some of the fifth grade people and greet them there. It's, you know, it's not back to school night, but... I know a lot of parents try to get to those things too, so
yeah, it's a
they
great
may not be able to get here, but maybe they can get to their local elementary school, because that is going to be real important, I think.
It is a great idea, and I actually had the opportunity, Ms. Donnelly took me through some fifth grade classrooms and introduced me to the fifth graders, which was a great opportunity so they could start to put a face to a name, and doing more of those outreach things at their sites is a great idea. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. I got to be here, I think it was last week? And was getting ready to leave campus, and Dr. Pruitt said, you really ought to stay another 15 minutes, or 10 minutes. Talked me into it. Can you explain to me the collaboration that was going on, or can you explain to everybody the collaboration that was going on, because I'll butcher it if I do it, but had something to do with calendaring between the grades?
Yes, we, as a staff, as a 6-8 staff, I want to just thank, and I'm so encouraged by my 7th and 8th grade teachers. We focus on the 6th grade component to this, but the 7th and 8th grade teachers at Loams have really embraced this idea of the STEAM concept. project-based learning and really trying to answer some critical questions. And so what we were doing as a staff is trying to determine some outcomes. We actually took the high school model of ESLRs, expected school-wide learning results, and had a discussion as a staff as to what we expect students to be as they leave us as eighth graders. What are those key educational components or learning skills that we want them to leave with? Once we determined that, we learned that we wanted to incorporate some intra-departmental units in the seventh and eighth grade. So they said, wait a minute, we don't want that just to happen in sixth grade. We want to do some of that project-based learning and work together as departments to deliver our instruction. So we knew, so the day that you visited us, we knew that one of the essential components that we needed to start to work on was to develop our instructional common instructional calendars to ensure that we are all aware of what everybody is teaching each week, every unit, throughout the entire year. So right now in our staff room, we have a very large whiteboard with a 13-14 calendar where each department is writing down what units they will be teaching and what week, so that when that board is complete within each of our departments, people will begin to see links. Wow, you're teaching mousetrap cars, and that's velocity. We're teaching that in mathematics. We could team together right there. And they'll link together and then do intra-departmental units. So they'll be able to visually see that on the whiteboard. And that was the work you saw happening that day. Yeah, pretty exciting stuff.
Glad you asked about that, Mark. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thanks, Dr. Pruitt. We'll give any members of the public that would like to speak on this item an opportunity.
Thank you.
Does anybody in the public would like to speak on this item? Okay, seeing no one, we'll bring it back to the board, and we will move to one of my favorite annual events, the resolution for the week of the school administrator. Go ahead. What festivities have planned for the
balloons,
week?
Balloons, cake, the works, no. That said, this week basically is week of the school administrator by the California Department of Education. Despite the tough times, the issues that we face, all of the things that seem to be coming down on education these days, the administrators in this district and in all the districts have a job to do. So the board has adopted initiatives, learning for all in all of our schools, and I will be the first to tell you that going to our principal meetings monthly, both elementary and secondary, seeing the work that Reed and Amy are doing with the directors of education here, that what Eric has put forward, and Rick and Russell and everybody else, all of the administrators in our district, definitely deserve some kudos and deserve to have some recognition for all of the great things that are going on right now. And there are great things happening in our district right now. Today we spent all morning talking about new math program and just the dynamics of change with teachers. And so it's being an administrator is a very, very difficult job. Very difficult job these days, but also very rewarding to work with the great staffs that we have. And so this is a great opportunity for the board to acknowledge the great work that is being done by the administrators in the district.
Great. Thank you. And there's a resolution, and in keeping with my time-honored practice, I'll ask Mrs. Holm to read it for us, and then we'll entertain questions and a motion.
A proclamation designating March 3 to 9, 2013, as the Week of the School Administrator. Whereas leadership matters for California's public education system and the more than 6 million students it serves, and whereas school administrators are passionate, lifelong, and school success, and whereas research shows great schools are led by great principals and great districts are led by great superintendents, these site leaders are supported by extensive administrative networks throughout the state. And whereas the state of California has declared the first full week of March as the week of the school administrator in Education Code 44015.1, and whereas the future of California's public education system depends upon the quality of its leadership, now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Trustees of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District proclaims March 3 to 9, 2013, as the Week of the School Administrator and encourages all citizens to participate in observance to express their appreciation.
Thank you, Mrs. Holmes. Excellent job, as always. And do we have any board comments or motion?
I'd like to make that motion.
I can't think of a more apt person to do so, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Buckman. Do we have any discussion by board members?
Public comment.
And any public comment on this item? Seeing no one, this is a roll call vote, but I think I can speak for the board that even though the recitations are a little tough with the whereases, I think we all agree with the content of it and congratulate our administrators and would like to impress on the public how fortunate we are to have such professional, dedicated folks in filling the many administrative jobs in this district. Mrs. Holmes, a roll call.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Passes 6-0.
Thank you. And we'll move on to item 8.02, which is a correction to a resolution that we passed earlier.
Unfortunately, I have to bring this back to the board tonight to revisit again, but some miscommunication between myself and our attorney in terms of the numbers that we had to list under the layoff resolution. So we had two potential, one retirement of a secondary counselor, as well as we had a resignation with one of our resource teachers in special education. So in the original resolution that came forward, those positions weren't listed, even though we were going to look at possibly cutting part of those positions. Speaking with the attorney, she wants to have those actually as part of the resolution, to have those numbers listed. This change in the resolution will cause no more layoffs to occur. So there's no additional layoffs, no more additional notifications that will happen because of this. It's more of just a clerical error that needs to be fixed.
Okay, and I apologize for not being able to raise this earlier, but I reviewed this item kind of late this afternoon. It's a resolution to adopt an amended attachment, but the board docs, there is no amendment. Is it?
We have it here.
Oh, okay, good. I couldn't find it on the board docs.
I didn't find it either.
Okay.
Second page is not there.
Okay, so we do have it. We do have it here. Any board members would like to review it or anything prior to the action?
It's just the two areas.
Okay, we can go to the public if there's anyone who wants to comment on this item while we're looking it over. Okay, bring it back to the board.
Do we need the reading of the resolution?
We should. Okay, maybe.
Do we know?
On advice from the clerk of the board, we will suspend the reading of the resolution, but we will entertain a motion regarding Resolution 12-12-13.
I'll make a motion that we adopt Resolution 12-12-13, the correction of clerical error.
And I'll second that. So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by the chair. Any discussion by board members? No? Roll call vote.
Mrs. Sheffer? Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 6-0.
Thank you. We'll move on to item 9.01, which is School Services of California Fiscal Analysis.
So, good evening, board. I'd like to frame out our next guest, and the reason that she's with us tonight is that given the fact that we knew we were going to be confronted with some difficult financial decisions in this coming budget process year. We went ahead and requested an independent review of our budget. And we contracted with School Services of California. They do fantastic work. And we just want to make sure that we're seeing this correctly. And so tonight, presented to you from School Service,
unaudited actuals, as well as your first interim report. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and I'll try to incorporate some of the comments that Mr. Millar made. I'll try to incorporate those in my presentation to put it in perspective as it relates to what was and now the current projections. Point over here.
Let me be your manager.
It's okay. Okay. So as part of our review, we looked at the point in time of the district's 12-13 interim report. And so we looked at not only the interim report, but all the assumptions and documents related to that, as well as detailed other district documents. Also, as part of our review, because we did a comparative review, we analyzed state-certified data based on district average daily attendance. We looked at some of those specifics, and we also, as part of the review, did an assessment of strengths and weaknesses as it relates to the district's financial condition. As I mentioned, we did a comparative analysis of revenues, expenditures, fund balance reserves, and staffing ratios using our statewide database. And so when we did that, we looked at the district in two different ways. We looked at the district as it compared to revenue limit districts of similar type and size, so unified districts that were similar in size but funded based on revenue limit. And then we also looked at districts that were community funded to do two slices of the pie to see how we receive revenue in this district compared to both revenue limit districts and community funded districts. So based on that, we also looked at the budget review that looked at all sources of revenue as well as the expenditures. We also looked at other funds in the district as they impacted the district's general fund. This review is not an audit. You have an annual audit. Ours was a review of your financial situation based on the first interim report, and it was a process designed to give the district a fair and independent assessment of how they looked in the current year and in their multi-year projections. So the report structure, I won't read these to you, but the way the report's set up, it's a more than 80-page document, and it's set up with some of these major topical areas that are covered in a detailed report. The comparative districts that we used are listed on the screen for you. The community-funded districts are on the left-hand side, and the revenue limit-funded districts are on the right-hand side. And throughout the report, in the second half of the report, probably starting on page 31, we have the comparatives slicing and dicing the way the district spends its dollars on a per ADA basis as compared to these comparative districts. As it relates to a major topical area, budget development, we recommend that you continue to develop your budget guidelines for each year. Mr. Miller spent quite a bit of time talking about the accelerated budget process that you're going to use for next year based on the fact you're planning to address your ongoing structural deficit. We think that it's good that you're using your website to get information out. I heard from board members tonight where they'd like to see additional community input on the way that certain dollars are spent, or as far as items that are listed for reductions. You'd like to see if you're able to slice and dice and the community could provide some input. We've found at school services that it's very important to take stakeholder input. Some of the ideas that stakeholders have aren't always practical or easy to implement, but it's very important for our community to be heard. So we think that that's a very good movement on the district's part to open themselves up in a variety of ways to gather input. Based on our review of your budget, our recommendation is that we need to keep that negative impact of the projected deficit spending and the fact that we don't know what Sacramento is going to do to us. We need to keep that in mind as we strategically make decisions for next year and out years. So the next two slides, the current slide and the slide after that, is going to show a snapshot of where you were at the first interim report and a few of the things that the district included in their first interim report that will certainly change with the second interim report. So a district is required to look at the current year and 2 years out as a multi-year projection, and it's required by law as part of AB 1200 and AB 2756. So when we look at current year, that's 12-13, and then 13-14 and 14-15 are our two subsequent years. And what we have listed here are the district's projections based on the first interim report. And so when we look at the next slide, based on the first interim report, I'll focus on 13-14 and 14-15. When we add back in the other adjustments, meaning the negative reductions that we had in there to align our expenditures, when we add back in those numbers, you can see the deficit spending is $5.5 million and $1.8 million in the out years. Mr. Miller did speak to the fact that you'll see adjustments in your second interim report that will improve the amount of deficit spending projected for current year. It'll improve it to the tune of $4.4 million versus the $7.6 million. But some of those out-year projections, you'll still see that your ongoing structural deficit is about as high as projected right there. And that's where, when we look at the nature of the district's budget and expenditures, adjustments need to be made because of the ongoing structural deficit and the fact that you're using your reserves to cushion the impact of offering programs while your revenue is dwindling. So this is a projection based on the first interim report showing contingencies, your ending fund balance. And if we, as we look at what we had in our first interim report, even in the first interim report, we were demonstrating from the district's assumptions, demonstrating that we had an ongoing structural deficit where we were spending down our reserves year over year. But when we add back in reductions that haven't taken place yet, you can see the blue line is school services projections. You can see where our fund balance is dwindling more quickly. And so the district historically has kept a higher than minimum reserve, and part of that is because you're a community-funded district. It's necessary for cash flow purposes to do that. It's also necessary for a district to do that based on the fact that when you're community-funded, there's no relief from the state when your circumstances change, so you have to absorb the hits. And so that's why it's really important for a district that's community-funded to have a higher than the state-required minimum reserve. So we can see with our contingencies, when we look at these numbers, we can see our savings account essentially is dwindling very quickly. And so the chart illustrates that we'll have big changes to our fund balance if we don't secure those expenditure reductions in the out years. So our recommendations are that you continue to identify and adopt the necessary reductions to curb the deficit spending. You want to be diligent in your efforts to maintain the fiscal solvency by addressing your ongoing structural deficit. And we recommend that your reserve stay significantly higher than the state-required reserve, the 3% reserve. And one comment I would make about your reserve is that when we look at what's happened to districts across the state, we've always been in a position where we've had to react quickly to what Sacramento and the state's economy may do to us. And so when we look at the district's reserve levels as compared to the statewide averages, our district is lower in our reserve level than the statewide averages, so that's something to take into consideration as we look at the out years. We need to keep that reserve level higher rather than bring it down. Another impact for us is the fact that we are a growing district, and generally, if you're a revenue limit district, when we're growing, we see that as a positive because additional funds come to us when we have additional enrollment that equates to higher ADA, and we receive additional funding from the state. We're not in that position when we're a community-funded district, and so what this chart points out is that year over year we can see our average daily attendance is growing, which means our enrollment is growing, but our property tax funding isn't growing at the same rate that we are. So if we just look at our property tax funding and divide it by our ADA, you can see our per ADA amount that we receive is going down. So we have additional pressure on our expenditure budget, because as we have more students, we need to hire more staff, we need to have more materials, we need to do things differently, and so our spending power as we grow is diminished. And so that's another dynamic that we need to recognize and deal with. So with enrollment and ADA projections, I won't read you all the bullets, but the percentage of our revenue derived from local property taxes is approximately 83%. So as we continue to grow, we're going to see, and as Mr. Miller pointed out, that Julie put together some projections based on the local control funding formula. And if we look at over a long period of time, if we continue to grow when they're allocating reductions, and so for community-funded districts, they looked at a way to apply a reduction, and they applied the reduction to our district in the form of reducing our categorical programs. And so that was more than $4 million in a reduction, and that is ongoing. So the fair share factor for this year is 9.57, and the projection should be ongoing in an 8.92% reduction. And so for all intents and purposes, that more than $4 million on an annual basis is something that you cannot count on. And so it's dollars that are no longer yours. So that's $4.3 million this year and projected to be ongoing. Another area that Mr. Miller talked about tonight, too, as we look at the current year budget, the district has been very proactive in funding their other post-employment benefit obligation. And so in this year's budget, the district is using some of the funds that are in Fund 20 to help offset some of the structural deficit. It's more than $1 million. We recommend that the district, when they are able to continue to fund those OPEB liabilities. You're in a good situation. We know right now it's difficult, but don't let your eye get off that prize, because you're very close in funding that OPEB liability. So that's something to just keep your eye on, keep it on your radar as it relates to your obligation. This is common sense. The district is doing this already. We recommend that you continue to monitor your budget line items throughout the year and make adjustments as appropriate. When Mr. Miller talked earlier this evening, he talked about changes in the budget. And sometimes we hear from folks when we go into districts, we hear comments about the numbers are always changing. Why does that happen? And what we would say to you is, as we adopt a budget and make adjustments for our revisions, we would expect those numbers to change over time. The closer we get to the end of the year, the better our projections become. And so when we see numbers that don't change, that's when our blood runs cold. So we feel comfortable when we see the numbers adjusting. We feel comfortable when we see the gap moving a little lower, because we budget conservatively, and when we have knowns in our budget, then we let dollars fall to the bottom line. So I would say that the level of comfort with the budget projections is appropriate as it relates to changes in the deficit spending for the current year. So I would say be comfortable with what you heard tonight. We would recommend that you align budgeted expenditures with the district goals. And what I mean by that is that, and Mr. Miller took this line here, but you're already in the process of communicating with your stakeholders about the issue. The issue is we have a structural deficit. The issue, much of it is as it relates to the fact that in Sacramento, they have an economic crisis in the state of California. They're making reductions across the state in education. We have taken more than $4 million in cuts on an annual basis. When we look at our structural deficit, at this point in time, it's projected to be about that. And so what we need to do as a district is look at what's important to us. You know, a lot of times we hear quite a bit about the people in the district and how very important they are. We absolutely agree with that. But when we look at programs and the way districts operate, programs are people. And so districts have to make decisions about how they can align their budget and manage their fiscal solvency and determine their priorities as it relates to what kind of offerings they'll have for students. So we would recommend that you look at district goals and then communicate with your key stakeholders that are involved with the programs. Understand the current needs that you have, what you were doing before. It may be that it needs to look different based on the fact that you have different resources to allocate. You have deficit spending. It's an ongoing structural deficit. You want to be sure that you are able to eliminate that pattern of deficit spending. Right now, I've already seen changes as far as revising the multi-year projections at the second interim report. It should only reflect expenditure reductions that the board has taken action on, expenditure reductions that have been negotiated. That would be a best practice so that you really can see the true picture of any decisions that you make now going into the future. And you need to take swift action to address what you need to cure next year's structural deficit. So the summary and conclusions as it relates to the report that school services put together, our fiscal solvency is classroom, but it also makes our salary schedule cost more because we have folks at the far end of the salary schedule. So that puts increased demand on our resources. Another thing that we noticed as we looked at some of the comparative data as it relates to district-wide administrators as compared to enrollment at school sites, we saw that, you know, we looked a little richer as it related to our administrator-to-student ratio. And part of that is based on the fact that we have small neighborhood schools compared to some of the other districts. And so if you look at economies of scale, that's one of the reasons that we noted that the numbers were a little different. So, for example, in some districts, their elementary schools, they may run about 800 students to a school site, and we may look at about, on average, 500 students. And so if you have a similar number of enrollment, but you have more schools, you have increased administrator costs because you have a principal at each site. So we noticed that. One of the other things that we noticed as it related to district-wide administration or district-level administration, when you look at those charts, you'll see that it's lean compared to both community-funded and revenue-limit districts. So that's something to take into consideration. Another comment, and I know that you guys are very aware of this, that basic aid or community-funded districts are always looked at, you know, with a squinty eye. Sacramento's very aware of you, and so you continue to be diligent in protecting that, and we always have to be careful as the rug or the game may change in front of us. It will be very important for the district to continue, because I know you've already started the work, to review your program design in order to get expenditures aligned with your revenue. And it's very difficult to consider cuts as it relates to people, but, you know, programs are people, or people are programs. Education is a labor-intensive endeavor. And so the majority of our expenditures are in salary and benefits, and so it's not that we don't look other places to make reductions, but many times districts have already done that, and so then we do have to look at the biggest part of our budget, which is labor, and that's salary and benefits, and that's an area that you will indeed need to look to as you try to manage your structural deficit. Success in aligning our budget is going to be dependent on staff recommendations to the board, and then action by the board and execution by district staff. We definitely have a fiscal challenge, and it's stemming from the state's economy, lower than anticipated property tax revenues, and on the natural increases in our expenditures. And with that, I open it up to you for questions.
Thank you for the presentation. And any board member questions? Are we all too stunned to think of it? Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I won't. How late do you want to stay?
No, go.
Okay. First of all, I want to pick up on something, your comment, and then the week of the school administrator, because while in some areas I think it's really phenomenal that we've maintained our ratio with students to principals, But on page 72, and I think it was figure 53, and I know you mentioned it, but I just want to make it really clear. Our ratio of students to district-level administrators is better than, I think, almost across the board except for Santa Cruz. And I think it's a real testament to the district to put its resources at the school site and not at the district office. So I just get that out. When I looked at this, I kept thinking about, and I'm going to just keep calling it what I think it is, the governor's weighted formula for funding. And I saw the charts on free and reduced lunch, and we're really, as you, the term you used was lean, but we're really low on the number of free and reduced lunches that we're providing. And if I read the weighted formula correctly, and please help me if I'm wrong, free and reduced lunches is going to be one of those factors that brings more money into a district. Is that?
You're correct. So free and reduced and English learner population and then foster youth.
Okay. So I think we may have talked about this before. I just really want us to be cognizant of the fact that we may have a lot more free and reduced lunch people, families in this community that qualify, and a really strong outreach and working with the school sites, the PTAs, and whoever can get to those families will ultimately help us as the state moves towards this, I'm calling it what it is, weighted formula. And that became real clear.
Districts, they have planned carryover to use for another purpose. My understanding is that in this district that they kept the integrity of the programs even though they were allowed to be used for any educational purpose, and that's the reason that they're still held in a resource or an account number. But there's a total of $4.5 million as of last year's unaudited actuals. As of right now, I couldn't speak to if there are any available balances.
No, maybe zero, but so I'm looking at this as a potential place to look for those dollars that we're going to need to find, because we can go in here if the board and the staff wanted to.
And what I would also point out here, if there are balances available, just to recognize these would be one-time resources.
Okay.
That wouldn't address the ongoing structural deficit, but could potentially be something that could ease or cushion some of what you need to address.
Okay. And just underneath that figure, there was a term used, lottery resource, and then I'm thinking this is a code number, the 1100.
Yes,
1.6, almost $1.7 million. I'm not familiar with the resource, the lottery resource.
Okay, so there's two ways that districts receive lottery dollars. It's based on annual ADA, and a portion of it is received in its unrestricted dollars, and then there's another portion of it that's related to a voter-approved initiative called Proposition 20 from
right.
A while back, and it's restricted for only instructional purchases. And so there also are, as of 11-12, not speaking for right now, there are dollars available there. There were fund balances as of 11-12. So there's two pots of money. One's restricted for educational purposes, mm-hmm. for instructional purposes, and the second part is unrestricted.
Okay. So if I can, do we still have any pennies in the piggy bank?
Well, I add two comments. Number one is that when we identify the particular categorical programs with a balance attached to them, the truth of the matter is that was for, as Maureen talked about, identifying where those funds originated from. However, they've been reconstituted as unrestricted money,
right.
And they're part of our reserves. They're part of our total savings account. And we can use them for whatever we want. They're not a pool of money to be plucked. It's just part of the overall pool. And then the lottery money, there's two particular definitions for it. One's restricted, one's unrestricted. But remember, we hold our lottery 1 year in reserve,
yep.
until the following year so we can determine exactly how much money we have. And that part is then released into the general fund to cover either the restricted or the unrestricted pieces by definition of Proposition 20 as it was passed.
And
just add to that what Mr. Miller has shared, and maybe I wasn't clear on, is that the dollar amounts listed here, they are part of last year's ending fund balance. They're included.
Okay. And across the state, are you seeing a reduction in lottery money coming in? I mean, it only accounts for about 2-3% of...
It's a very small percentage. In most districts, it's maybe 1-1.5%. Not a lot of money.
I'm still running into people that are saying, well, but we gave you all that lottery money.
Didn't that cure you? No,
yeah.
It did not.
Okay, and then I'm running into people that are saying, and I don't understand why you're whining because we just gave you Prop 30. So.
And that's a very good question, and I think it's important enough if I could just take a minute to talk about that. Proposition 30 was very important, its passage for education, because what it meant for us is that we didn't take another cut. It didn't change the cuts that we've taken since 2008-2009. On average, we've taken more than 20% in cuts on an ongoing basis. Proposition 30, by its passage, meant that we didn't take a mid-year cut, and for most districts, it would have been more than $400 per ADA. And so while we're very grateful to voters that it passed, it doesn't change our circumstance now. It doesn't make us whole. We still are running a 22% deficit. So essentially, we're getting 78 cents on the dollar that we're entitled to.
Okay. Thank you. And I appreciate all the charts. It really made it easy to look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate that. Any other questions by board members? Okay, seeing none, we'll give the public a chance to comment on this, and then maybe you could come back up for some final thoughts and comments. Is there anybody in the public that would like to speak to the board on this issue? Okay, don't sit down yet. Seeing no one, we'll bring it back to the board. Any final thoughts?
And CTE are terminologies that we sometimes use interchangeably but can mean different things. And CTE, as Rick will explain in a minute, has taken preeminence in the educational world in terms of ROP, and it's the same kind of programs. And what we're going to talk about tonight is not ROP or CTE, it's the JPA. Nobody in our district that I have found would diminish the value of ROP or slash CTE. I use both of them because Rick's going to explain it to you. But the value of those programs is undeniable. But what we have going with the JPA is in my mind, an outdated model that doesn't recognize what's going on in today's financial world. Not educational world, but financial world. And what I mean specifically, there are two particular concerns I have about how the JPA is governed and how it runs. First of all, the 10 districts, now there are 9, actually there's 7 because 2 more have joined Coast. So Templeton, Coast, and Atascadero have now formally issued a resolution of withdrawal from the JPA. Lucia Marr has one on its board meeting tonight, and we'll see where that one goes. And it's in relation to two things. One is there's a $150,000 allocation from the ROP funds the state receives to support administration. And they hire from that a superintendent of ROP, if you will, and they hire a secretary and they hire a financial analyst. And what my concern is, I'm not sure that we're seeing great value for our share of that $150,000, which when we had 9 districts was about $35,000. The other part of this is that we have reserves that are stuck in the JPA and we can't get them out. And by that I mean we have accumulated
reimbursed funding. We gave them money. We didn't spend it all, and they keep it in their reserve account. And by the end of this year, it'll be in excess of $400,000. And what I had asked of the JPA 2 weeks ago was to consider returning to us $200,000 of the funding in order for us to use it to mitigate some of our issues. And I was told that that wasn't in the bylaws, wasn't allowed. When Paso Robles entered into their significant financial problems, they asked for the same thing and were denied access to the reserve money. I think that the JPA misses the point of how districts are struggling and what they need to do to coexist with us. And what I want to I want to do now is turn it over to Rick in terms of the CTE component of all of this and let him speak to that piece so you understand what we're going to ask for next.
Okay, I'll try. The acronyms get confusing. So obviously, as you know, ROP, Regional Occupational Program, set of dollars the school districts get. It's become flexible dollars. They come in with a lot of rules attached to them. The rules have been changed because they're flexible dollars. We're part of a joint powers agreement, JPA, that controls that. And I think what is important, and I think the board fully understands this, is we're fairly committed to career technical education, CTE, in this district. Whether it's an ROP course or it's another course, you know, we've made that commitment. I think the demonstration of what we're doing with coding at the middle school, what will happen in the future of the elective programs in career technical education, with our all of our STEAM initiatives in the strategic plan, we're pointing to the need to probably expand career technical education. And so I guess I think what Mr. Miller is asking is to make sure that whether we continue to be part of an organization that kind of governs the funding mechanism, or whether we decide not to be part of that, it probably has very little to do with the courses we offer or our commitment to career technical education. Does that kind of do it?
That's perfect. At least it was for me. And it's to emphasize that we still value the educational component. And in fact, what we would like to do is recommend to the board the passage of a resolution that would allow us to withdraw from the JPA, get our reserves, and continue to offer the same classes under our own umbrella rather than the JPA umbrella. And we would what we would lose is a collective intelligence such as it is within the JPA. And they have discussions. They have board meetings every month. Mr. Buckman represents the district's interest at those board meetings. And they have lively exchanges of information and direction that we should be going. Okay, so that's what we would lose in a large sense. What we would gain is resources in order to implement and help fund our own ideas about what CTE looks like for San Luis Coastal. Go ahead.
Can I just add one more thing? I think one of the things that we would have to carefully negotiate if we were to withdraw is there certainly are some what you might call regional programs that we're part of. And I think with the advent of all the technological stuff, what we're finding is there are computer-based courses that we are part of regionally. So we would probably have to still sort of negotiate terms for some of those courses. We may charge for other districts to enter into our courses. We may pay to have our students be involved. So there might be some, you know, regional cooperation. It doesn't necessarily require a joint powers agreement, but we may do some contractual services. So that could be a potential loss, but I think it could be mitigated.
It's an entrepreneurial aspect to this operation. So you develop, and Mr. Beckman was key in talking about distance learning opportunities, and actually there is a distance learning opportunity within the JPA, but that doesn't mean we wouldn't be able to access or approve it or actually offer other distance learning opportunities too. It's just we could then sell, if you will, market our program to other districts to participate with us in it. Many districts are too small in terms of resources to be able to to do all of the essential work to make that viable. But if we all banded together, and that was the original precept of the JPA, then those things can be accomplished.
Okay, Marilyn.
Thank you. I understand what we're talking about here, but I guess I want clarification on a couple of things. The money that would be returned to us would not be restricted to CTE or ROP, but rather would go into our general fund. Is that correct?
Correct.
So if we were, if the board were to approve a withdrawal from the JPA, could it be with the stipulation that there is no reduction to the courses currently offered for ROP or CTE?
One of the things that we would remind the board is they control the course offerings. So if you see value in any course, you continue it. If you see diminished value, you alter it or discontinue it. And this would be no different. And we would certainly look at all of the programs and all of the things that we have in place. I think that we have done a great job in staying current on value. Mm-hmm. So my initial response is that we would not have a recommendation to eliminate or change anything. Maybe add. We have a couple of ideas about ads. But
yeah, and I'm all in favor of ads. I'm a strong proponent of CTE and ROP. And so maybe I should just swivel my neck from looking at you to looking at my fellow board members and say, are we interested in expressing a commitment to maintain the current level and expand it if and when we're able? Given that the monies are unrestricted, so we would need to be making the commitment, the philosophical commitment, I guess, that we value these courses and we want to maintain them.
So is the question, when we got the $400,000 back, we would
right because it
to
would
spending
become
spending it for tech
the
ROP or tech.
That we want to maintain our current level of programmatic support for those for ROP and CTE, and that even though the monies that we get back will be unrestricted, which means we don't necessarily have to use them for that purpose, that as a board we have a commitment to maintaining at least our current level.
Okay. Can I help with this?
Sure, if you think you can.
I think that what Marilyn is talking about is that does the board maintain a commitment to the philosophy of CTE? And as such, we wouldn't want to take a resolution to continue absolutely forever everything we do today, because technology changes, and in fact some of our additional ideas relate to technology. And so we would like the board to be flexible in its approach to CTE and
occurring within our elective programs, an evolving of how we're educating kids. And I think what we know is that ROP courses are driven by student interest enrollment. And so it behooves us, and obviously the board, to support what the students and the staff have a compelling interest in developing. So from my perspective, that's really what you're saying, is let's not get in the way of that. Because that money would, if we were to disband from the ROP or the JPA and receive these monies, I think you're asking for assurance that we will not lose momentum in support of that those monies currently encouraged. So I would say to you, our initiatives, the way they're designed, encourage the ongoing support of CTE courses and opportunities for kids, and that's what we're trying to do. So I will be coming to you not necessarily to maintain what we currently have forever and ever. I imagine I'll be coming to you and saying, let's consider these modifications, these adjustments. It will be things we haven't even considered yet. And I imagine those things will emanate from the students and the staff in the form of high interest programs. That's my response. So I think we're there. I really believe
okay.
We're there.
I think we're probably on the same page. I see Don Rapucci out there, and I'm thinking, well, you know, what about his welding classes that are funded through ROP? Now that money is no longer restricted, might we decide that, well, gee, we really need it for transportation? I mean, that would be a board decision. And I just want to make sure that there's not a winnowing of ROP and CTE options for students.
Okay, Jim? Well, that was interesting. I mean, I had a totally different interpretation of what Marilyn was saying, which was if we're going to get this money back and we want CTE, let's put our money where our mouth is and so forth. But maybe that wasn't the exact interpretation. But anyway, that was my take on it. My question actually has to do with two things. One is our withdrawal will effectively end the JPA because it'll be just PASO and a few small districts left. And then if I want to know if that's correct. And number two, is there any legal ramifications for our withdrawal?
On the first question, it's possible that we would be the final nail, but it's probable that whatever action the CMR takes tonight would have a more significant impact than our action at the next board meeting. There are no legal ramifications that I'm aware of beyond the act of withdrawing through a resolution prior to April 1st. The bylaws of the JPA have incorporated how people can withdraw and what happens in that sequencing of events.
Ellen?
So I'm kind of slow on some of this money stuff. I want to make sure that I understand. First of all, it is in the initiatives already under the increased access to college and career pathways. So that's not, I would be right with you if these things started going anywhere. I don't think that's going to. We're a district that's already about a lot of this, but we have line items for these classes, and we've accepted additional. We've had new course offerings, as I recall, this school year to offer additional CTE classes, so I think that the community at large and the district is supportive of that. But with the money, I'm sorry to be sort of dense about this, but this $400,000, that's not money that isn't that separate and apart from how we've been financing these classes to begin with. I mean, it's a different little pot of money. Is my understanding,
you're right. It's actually a savings account that's been accrued over years of unspent money. So, in essence, we earn money from the state of California for our ADA inside of the JPA classes. They pay us X number of dollars per ADA. And that money is funded or funneled into the JPA. And then we are reimbursed from the JPA for the expenses of the classes we offer. Over the years, our ROP type classes have been so popular, we have exceeded our ADA allocations and thus have received more money than other districts. And that money, while it has come in, hasn't been spent. And so it has accumulated.
Okay, that's
I didn't want to get into that piece tonight. Sorry, Marilyn.
We can handle it.
Well, you got it. I'm proud of you. That's great. I just wasn't sure I would complicate or confuse the issue by explaining that. But since you brought it up, we're already funding ROP from our general fund. The state doesn't send us a single penny for our obligation to the JPA.
So now my question is,
why are we in it?
Well, it made sense at one time.
I'm getting blamed now. Watch this.
Right. I hope.
I feel like I'm at home with my wife. Go ahead.
So now my question is, the $400,000 becomes one-time money.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That goes into the general fund.
Yes.
And will probably be used for some relief on the budget. And we will continue out of the general fund to fund our ROP courses.
Yes.
Why didn't you just say that in the beginning?
Well, we still call them.
I'm sorry, honey. I didn't mean it. I'm really good at apologizing.
It's rather deteriorating. I think Marilyn's message is really important, and I think we really need to listen to it, and I think we need to listen to it back with the old term of ROP. Because as we talk about CTE and career pathways, and we talk about new and wonderful technology, society still needs welders, construction, and
auto mechanics.
And so when you're asking for a commitment to ROP programs, that's what I'm hearing you say. If there's new and more wonderful things, I think, you know, we'll find the funding and we'll adopt the classes. So I just want to make sure I'm hearing what you say. Most if not all of our current ROP classes are A to G certified, so those students are building up units to get into UC and CSU schools. So I think that's important to remember as well. So I just, and there's, we, it's been hard during these times sitting on the JPA to keep the two topics separate. There's been a lot of defense of ROP, and I think all of, I'm seeing a lot of shaking heads. We all believe in the welding and the construction and the fact that we have students that are coming out of high school that are career ready. And so I would just clarify that. So in January, the ROP board got a letter from superintendents asking us to re-examine, to join with them to re-examine and form a committee, the structure or how we do a regional program. And that has morphed at the JPA level, in a vote at the emergency meeting last week, into a meeting. The superintendents had proposed 9 people, and it's now morphed into probably more than 20 people that are going to try and sit around the table and hash this out. And that was the vote that was taken. As a board member, I support that, but not all of us were in favor of it. It's a very large group.
What are they hashing out?
According to what I, the way I'm reading this letter is some kind of new organization, new regional organization that would function either differently or the same as the JPA. But let me get to that. And just, I appreciate that. That's a good question, Walter. The current structure of the JPA and the way the Ed Code reads for ROPs is that the classes actually come from a top down, and local businesses are at the top level, and the local businesses tell us what the trends they see, and then we build ROP classes around those trends. Right now, there's one group of businesses that works with the JPA and provides the trends for the region, and I think that that's a good model to continue. It's not necessarily the JPA, but the businesses are letting us know what their needs are. I think through CTE, we'll be looking at the future trends and this coding program. Just, you know, I wrote down, I'm going to go online and try to learn how to code. Maybe be up all night. There's one of the questions that has come up is both the question of the reserves and administrative costs. And our current investment into the administrative costs is about $35,000. So I think as we consider this, we need to think about, we're still going to need to administer this program. And so what is that cost? It's the cost of someone. So some of the structures and some of the issues may actually relate to bylaws and not necessarily to the value of the JPA. One of the things to remember when districts are talking about $450,000 in a reserve, it's the money could have been spent, and we didn't go in and say, well, we want to spend it on these things. You'll note many times in our consent agenda item that materials and a lot of stuff are paid for out of the ROP. I believe it was one of our teachers at the last JPA meeting who said, well, we've been setting aside money for a project, but it may have been somebody from Paso. But that's often used as a bank for large purchases. And so that's out there. Excuse me if I just look at my notes. Okay. So one last thing. This was an article in AXA, Ed Week. I think it was very recent, and I'm just going to read one sentence out of it. Only 5 out of the 74 regional occupation centers and programs in California are run by a single school district. So somewhere in the state of California, 74 ROPs, other communities are seeing a value in having a JPA rather than their individual districts running the program. And if there's questions that I can answer, having been on the JPA for a number of years, I'd be happy to answer them. But I just want to give you the information so we make this decision before we make this decision.
Well, I think Ellen had a light on.
Oh, well, I guess I just wanted one more time to be able to confirm that there will be no confirm for me, whoever over there will do such confirming, that there would be no decline in our offerings, no diminishment in our continued pursuit of determining what is what those trends are, what would best, how to best serve our students in those areas of CTE and ROP offerings, in alignment with the initiatives and in alignment with just good community education practices.
I think that would be the board's decision as we move along. I think that one of the values the JPA used to have was there used to be a lot of rules associated with ROP, and now there's because the money is flexible, those are relaxed, and that's why you're seeing probably throughout the state a lot of wiggling around with those funds. But I think that the board's priorities are going to dictate the courses and the programs we offer, whether or not we still abide by some of those rules, like Mr. Buckman's talking about, the business connections and some of those things that have been a value of the ROP program, would also be things we'd have to look at and coordinate and perhaps manage ourselves if we were to pull
out.
But
we valued that not because of the JPA, is my understanding, or did that?
Probably at this point we do. And you have to understand, we fund programs not just from ROP fundings, and we have ag incentive grant funds,
right.
We have Perkins federal funds that come in, we apply for vocational grants to fund programs, so I think all of that would be something we would still continue to administrate.
So are you indicating that in the past, were it not for the JPA, we would not have had the extensive offerings that
we had a lot of rules we had to follow, and so the JPA helped us stay focused on our rules. We had caps, we had enrollment numbers. In order to offer a class, you had to reach a certain threshold in order to get funded back. Am I correct in all this? That's all been very relaxed, which I think would cause some angst in school districts, because people would want to just grab that money, put it in the general fund, drop those programs. That's why the board just needs to remain diligent, and we need to remain diligent as your staff to offer the programs and the parameters that you would want us to have on those programs.
So, I think Chris is up.
So, I don't know if I'm Don Rapucci sitting out there. I'm wondering what this all means for my classes at Morbay High School. And I was going to save it for board reports, but Mr. Quisenberry and I were there last Thursday, and he had done a construction project, an engineered house, that essentially they built the one room of a house with electricity, water, plumbing, stuff like that. I think that we all value CTE, whether it be ROP or not, and I think
It's never been about the class offerings. We're going to continue our commitment as long as the board wants to, to ROP. What this issue is all about is a dysfunctional system of governance. And I belong to a number of different boards throughout the state of California, and not a single one of the JPAs that I go to for you guys has board members making decisions. It's CBOs. It's instructional people. And what has happened is that this structure of the JPA has outlived its time in this world. And what needs to happen, and my prediction is, what needs to happen is this needs to break down and be put back together in a different format in coming years. Because there is great value in collective wisdom. There is great value in looking at economies of scale and this kind of operation. But when the JPA has rules that they refuse to address for political reasons, then the practical aspects of the educational program are lost. So what we have had is a political process subverting the educational programs of the JPA and how it should have been offered. That's my personal opinion.
And if I may conclude, I think I'm assuming that Lucia Marr is going to pull out.
I think so. But
okay. So I suspect that we're going to need to bring this back next meeting, and I think we better have a resolution to withdraw from the JPA. We better be ready for it, and then at that point we maybe can look at further, because we'll have to have a second read. You know, essentially we haven't even had a first reading of this, but we'll need to take care of it by next meeting. And then the discussion will be, as we continue budget talks, is this something that's of value to us? And if somebody comes up with a better idea from the county regional level, then we can explore that. But I think at this point, we better be ready to go out on our own, and I think we better be ready to have that presented to us at the next meeting.
So I don't disagree with what Chris is saying. And I think one of the valuable things about the letter and the timing of the letter is, if something else does get created, you can rescind the letter. In fact, last year Templeton put a letter on the table, and the JPA made some changes, and Templeton rescinded their letter. So I appreciate the comments, and I think you're right on. And as we look at this as a board, or at least what I'd like to bring to the table, is not only the value that Mr. Miller was talking about, the historical knowledge and the ability, but also the first word is region, and I think we need to continue to keep in our thoughts, in our planning, that it's a regional approach. And so in the future, I think we need to consider that as well. And many of these things may be able to be addressed by this joint meeting with the superintendents and the advisors and the ROP board, and there may be other tactics for dealing with it. So just if we all remember, the letter can be rescinded.
What do you need from us tonight?
Nothing, just direction. I was to come back on the March 19th board meeting with a recommendation for action.
Well, it may be unfortunate that the organization has sort of outlived its usefulness in its present form and is a little slow out of the gate in trying to reform itself, but I support Chris's view that we need to have a recommendation that that helps us be prepared for what may have already happened tonight in Lucia Marr. Okay. And other board members, we have consensus on that direction for the. Okay. Thank you. We'll move on to item 9.04, Summer School 2013.
Actually, we got 903.
No, we have the reorganization of fiscal services.
I was already on that one. Sorry about that. Reorganization of fiscal services, Mr. Miller.
Thank you. This is a item to request the creation of another position in fiscal services and the reallocation of several duties that would make this a no additional staffing need. So I want to be clear, we're not adding staffing, we're just reorganizing somewhat. The impetus behind this and the practical aspects of it is we need a third payroll clerk for our who can cross-train into both the certificated and classified payroll positions so that if an unfortunate incident were ever to occur to an individual, we would not be paralyzed in terms of getting payroll out. So it became apparent to me that in working through several problems, it wasn't the competence, it was the complexity that was at issue. And the creation of this third position will allow us to address several concerns, and we're going to do it without additional people, additional positions.
So you're going to redefine an existing position or eliminate an existing position and then have the Personnel Commission define a
new position? In essence, we have two positions now that we will alter somewhat. One is a facilities clerk who also does accounts payable work. And we will take the facilities work and move it to a individual who has done it in the past and currently has capacity to take it back. We will take the accounts payable piece and move it to another individual who has done it in the past and has capacity to do it again. So two people will get an additional responsibility each, and that person whose duties have been migrated to other people will go into payroll, learn the position, and act as the third payroll clerk. So nobody loses a job, and nobody is going to be overburdened with jobs that they can't do.
Okay. The board question, Marilyn?
Yeah, thank you. I don't really understand why this is a board issue. If we're talking about just a redistribution of responsibilities and no additional hiring, I could see where it would be a Personnel Commission issue. If it could be if you were creating a new position and needed to define it. But with no additional hiring involved, I don't really see how it's our issue.
One of the things we do is that we bring to the board the creation of new positions. What?
Uh-oh.
Oh, let the HR expert answer
true.
This.
And also there's a budgetary amount that's tied to this, and so we need the board to approve the increase in funds for that new position. So that's why.
So there's no new hire, but there's...
But there is a budget. Changing that account clerk position to
payroll.
The payroll is, and I believe it's on the board.
$4,000 to $5,000. That says
basically.
So has this... The creation of...
So what will happen is the first thing, the board would approve the budget for that to happen, and then I will be taking this to the Personnel Commission at the next meeting to basically allocate the position, go through the next part of it.
So we're just about the money aspect of it?
Basically.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there any member of the public that would like to address the board on this issue? Seeing no one, we'll get back to the board. Any further questions or discussions? So do you need a motion or consensus? Motion? Okay. Yeah, Jim.
I move the approval of the reorganization of fiscal services.
And I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Questenberry, second by Mrs. Roger. Any further discussion?
Can I ask one question, Mr. Miller?
Sure.
Mr. Miller, as we look at the technology that's going to exist probably in the near future or currently, is there a chance that we're going to reach a point where we're going to have the technology that can handle the more complexity that's been built into the contracts, so that we might be able to do this with less?
If I understand your question, I don't think so. What we have is we have a program that... Are you asking about the technology that we use in order to... process payroll?
Yeah, will there be improved technology to process payroll as opposed to...
Yeah, I mean, the technology continues to evolve, and the county office runs the program, and they actually purchased a program from vendors who stay in touch with all of the changes within the law and stuff. But what we have are contracts. And as an example, a bus driver can have, I think it's up to 5 different ways to earn money. You got differential, you got overtime, you got straight time, you got long time, you know, long run, all kinds of different ways to, and their time sheets come in, and they're very complicated. And it's very simple to just kind of make a mistake on the complications of it all. And so we don't have the 35-year experienced employee anymore who could look at that timesheet and actually say, no, that's not right, this is right. I mean, they could take the actual timesheet and alter it. And now what we're doing is we're inputting exactly what's on the timesheet.
Notices because of statutory timelines before really discussing the impacts. And I know that's tough on you as a board and it's tough on our employee groups. Tonight I have before you another such issue that we are asking the board to weigh in on independent of other budget cuts because of the timeline implications. We would like you to act hopefully by the next board meeting in order for us to plan appropriately, and the issue is summer school for this coming summer. Summer school last year served 17% of our student body. The students represented some of our neediest, with a disproportionate number of students in the EL, migrant ed, economically disadvantaged, students in AVID, those at risk of not graduating from high school. Therefore, it's not a light matter to suggest a serious curtailment for the coming summer of our robust summer school program. We spent over $200,000 last year on summer school, and we would likely spend at least $250,000 this summer if we offered the same type of program. And based on our structural deficit, staff believes we should not do that. Summer school is a rarity in the state of California in these days. It is not offered in our county anywhere else except for small programs like those that I will be suggesting. And even that is rare. Summer school is not required for a school district to offer. A savings of this amount in our budget will not affect anyone's job and will make a difference in the $4.5 million we will need to deal with in our bigger picture. But make no mistake, students will be affected. So we'd like to just kind of give the board the ability to discuss and provide any impact or any future considerations for us for the next board meeting on these topics. No summer school for the elementary and middle schools. It is possible that some school sites may try to offer some sort of small-scale program, perhaps at our Title I schools, but frankly, the pending sequester cuts of 8.5% to Title I may quash those possibilities. Maybe we can do some program for migrant students, because there might be some migrant ed funds. But overall, the cost of providing teachers, administration, aides, clerical, transportation for K-8 summer school is something we believe we should do without this summer as part of our budget reduction necessity. Secondly, we believe we can offer a credit recovery program at the high school level at one or two sites according to interest in much the same way that we do credit recovery in collaboration with our adult school during the school year. We have a computer-based program, the A++ program. We have 25 site licenses that we would not have to purchase new license. We can use them for the summer. A double session program, 2 to 4 days a week, depending on the number of interests, would allow us to run a credit recovery program for students needing that at the high school level for probably less than $10,000. It would, again, depend on enrollment and sites and how we would staff that. We already have that in place, so we know how to do that program. We also are hopeful, a third thing, is that we're hopeful that we can make an arrangement with Cuesta College to offer original credit social science courses in order that students that are in high school who have traditionally used summer school in the past to allow for room in their coming years for electives, especially in the music and the CTE ROP areas, and for students who are in the AVID program. This is especially true at Morro Bay High School. That's where we've seen that utilized to the greatest extent. Cuesta can receive ADA apportionment in the summer, and we think that they can work out some arrangement. They have been our provider over the last 2 years. We've run summer school, had it at our sites, but Cuesta has been paying the teachers for those particular programs, and we believe we can work out some arrangement with that. Special education programs, which really are about extended school year, is not summer school. We shouldn't think of special ed summer school as summer school. It's extended school year. It's an IEP service that we are required to offer for some of our special education students, so we would not be proposing any change to this. So our request tonight is for you to ask questions, give us a sense of any area where you would like more information, you know, so that we can bring back a more formal request at our March 19th meeting. Elementary schools would normally have already been starting to register students. They'll begin their summer school registration in earnest if we were to offer it in the next few days, because they do that during parent conference week. High school students are in the middle of starting their registration process this month, which is why we're bringing this to you at this time. It's one of those things where we don't think we can wait if the decision is going to be to go forward or not to go forward. So leave that for your discussion.
Okay. Is there anybody in the public who wants to speak on this item? Seeing no one, bring it back to the board. Any board member comments, Chris?
Yeah. I would reluctantly accept the suggestions that you have put forward, dropping out, and that's not something I would support. But otherwise, I think this is a good plan, a sad but good plan.
Mark?
Just a couple of thoughts. If I'm doing the math right, this is a program that's costing us about $170 per child. Do you know? Can you remind me how long summer school is? It 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
We have typically a 4 week elementary program. We've had some kind of boutique. We call them boutique 5 week. Elementary program, and we've had some boutique program. We call them boutique programs. I don't know why, but at some certain elementary schools that have had varying length, and the secondary summer school is typically 6 weeks, and we offer it in two sessions. Is that right? Yeah.
Okay. And
so I don't know the per student cost.
It's probably wrong. Russell will correct me. And then my second question is, as I hear about the subgroups that we're serving, as I understand it, we still do meals probably during summer school.
We do.
And are we doing breakfast and lunch or just breakfast? Or just, just
good
lunch?
Good question. Mrs. Shields, do you
just
know?
Lunch?
Two meals. If they should,
it's two meals
they're
a day.
There, they get a snack.
Snack and lunch. Okay. And I just, I'm a little concerned about that. We have some kids that may be all they're getting.
Yes.
I suppose this is just a comment, but in seeing what we're having to do here as a result of our finances, and thinking that, you know, I would only support this knowing that it is a hiatus, a one-time only deal, although I could certainly see it coming before us again at some point. I just think, I wonder how close to the bone are we going to get here? I mean, we're having to carve away so much that I see as our identity as San Luis Coastal, and I know that we're going to come through this and we'll remain strong and we'll maintain that identity. But this is just really difficult to know that we're touching, you know, hearing about the programs that kids may not have meals because we won't be able to provide the educational programs that fold that in, and these are just really trying times. So that's my cheerful little comment. But on that note, I will support this, and looking into a few of the things that have been raised tonight would be helpful.
So it appears we have board consensus to consider a less robust summer school program and have staff explore more cost-effective measures similar
to
some of the ones that were outlined. And for Chris's point, I'd be interested in what our numbers are of eighth graders who are in danger of not moving on to high school.
Good point. Thank you.
Is that summarize things for the board? Okay.
I just want to play with if it's at all possible to add to this mix. Is there something that our family, the new family center in St. Louis and the one at Sunnyside can do to possibly pick up the slack for those families that are we're going to have
as far as the meals situation?
As far as the meals, and I don't know if they're allowed. I just don't know what the rules are, Russell, for that money. How to get that money?
We'll find out.
We'll investigate that. That's a really good point, Mark. Thank you.
All right. We'll move on to 9.05, a review of public comment practices. Ms. Holmes.
Thank you. I thought that it might be helpful if we had an opportunity to kind of look at the practices we've followed for a while in light of the excitement our audience raised last time. So I've brought to you the government code that specifies how we have to offer that opportunity to the public to speak, commonly referred to as the Brown Act, and the bylaws and guidelines that we publish for the community. And my interest is in having you discuss those overall to see if we feel that we're complying with the requirements of the Brown Act, and to see if there are any revisions you might like to see in our bylaws or our practices. And then if we do make any of those changes, if we want to think about how we communicate those in our agenda packet, because it seems that there may have been some confusion on the part of the public. I've been in the district for 26 years, so a lot of things are just sort of second nature to me now, having attended these meetings for so long. But I realize that the people in our audience only come to us occasionally, and so what I might take for granted, they do not always understand the same way I do. So my interest is in making sure that we all understand how we're going to operate this. Last meeting that was so
contentious.
Volatile, contentious, good word, was perhaps the public confusion that limit of 20 minutes applies also to individual meetings. So I'm asking for some clarification of if that is what the board wants to continue, if that's your understanding, and make sure that we find a way to explain that in our documentation so that everybody follows the same practices.
Thank you, Kim. I'll start off by commenting on the February 19th meeting. I think the problem was that by waiving the time limits in the previous two meetings without making an overt waiver of that I think some of the advocates at the meeting began to see that as, I don't know whether entitlement is the right word, but an expectation that would show up at every meeting. So for me, the error that I made as chair was not making it clear at the previous two meetings, the meeting of, I think, the 18th of January and the 5th of February, that we were suspending our normal time limits and really basically just opened it up for as long as somebody wanted to speak. In our history, we have done that before. When we closed elementary schools, Patty Andreen was board chair, and we made a board decision that we were just going to allow people to speak. It was just too contentious of an issue, and we wanted to make sure that people were heard. One of the most satisfying comments that I heard from a number of community members and parents after the school closures were that even though they didn't like the decision that was made, that they felt like they had an opportunity to be heard. So by announcing at the February 19th meeting that we were not going to suspend the rule and limit it to 20 minutes for each agenda item and 20 minutes for a public comment, unscheduled public comment, I think it caught some people by surprise. I will add that as a matter of fact, I don't think anybody in the public was deprived of an opportunity to be heard. I think there was a lot of hoopla and not much reality there. So with those comments having been made, I'll just say that in my experience, this policy has worked well. The way we affect it is what we need to improve. And one of the things is making sure that there is a conspicuous information. To be honest with you, it is pretty conspicuous, but I think we obviously, when we hand out a different version of the agenda and make it available at the meeting, it needs to be clearly stated on that. But I think the board protocol, if we were to retain this approach, would be to take specific action each time we decide to waive the rules. I also want to add that in a little over 12 years, that this has only been an issue one time, and that was February 19th. So I'll turn it over to my other board members for comments. Chris?
Sure. Mark and I received an email from Catherine this morning, so that did not violate the Brown Act. And help me with this, Mark, if you will, reading through it, I think she basically agreed with what you're saying, that I think, framing it from my point of view, we either need to say this is the time that we will spend on public comment or on comment per item as something that is regular for us, and then extend it depending on the circumstance, overtly extend it. Because I think you're right, Walter. I think exactly what you said is we've sort of had this rule there, but rarely during public comment do we ever get over 20 minutes. And when we have hot topics, we typically get more than 20 minutes, but we let it go because we want to hear from everybody. So actually what Catherine is saying is she likes the rules as they are, but, and Eric, you can help me out too because you were copied on this, but that we would, as a board, if we want to extend it beyond the 20 minutes, that the board should take action to extend the comment period so that the public knows that it's been extended by the board. And then Mark and I were talking about it, and we've seen this. I think Lucia Marr has something. I would be strongly in favor of having a clock or something here that counts down the time for people's comments so that they can see it.
And if I can.
Thank you. And I think, did I capture what Catherine said
Catherine.
Pretty well?
Yeah. Okay. I think we have a clock that's linked and is large enough so that the audience can see it. So, and this will go to my next point, so that the audience is very aware of what the time is being used, because I think one of the things we miss when we talk to the public and describe the process is that it's not the board that we're so worried about. I'm more than willing to listen. It's respect for the other people in the audience that want to speak. So if you're going over and everybody's going over, then the person that's at the end of the line for the 20 minutes doesn't get to speak. And so the clock, I think, will help let the speakers and the other people in the audience know when 3 minutes is up. And it's purely out of respect on our part for the people that want to speak. So I'm going to push along with Chris for just I know, kitchen timer is nice, and I tried to, we've used a smartphone before, but I think it's just time to get. And then the other suggestion that I would make is we've tried to do a lineup of four or five people. The Board of Supervisors, they have two separate microphones. So on evenings when we're expecting a crowd, we had a left and a right microphone. It's going to make things go much faster. I just make those two recommendations.
Well, I just want to add to the suggestion that we have a large timer. I understand that Board Docs has one that could be projected on the screen. Is that correct? Or
there is some kind of a timer, because I'm looking at the part of the program that monitors the meeting on my computer. And I think that I would have to activate that on this computer that projects the items on the screen. I'm not real familiar with how that works. I've been talking as well to my counterpart in Lucia Marr, because I know that they have that timer. And she indicated to me that that's a fairly old piece of equipment, so they're in the market for something new as well. And Mrs. Simoes is shopping and has found me some options, so we're trying to see how that would work. We've talked differently about, you know, a timer that's projected on the screen, and I'm concerned about that because of our logistics. The speaker is looking at you, so the timer needs to be there, directly visible, rather than on the screen, which would only benefit the audience, and only if they look that way, because I think everybody's tending to look forward.
The other thing is that we do have the guidelines for public comment published on the yellow sheets that we send out, but I would also think that to, you know, when we get to that portion of the agenda, to project it on the screen, and then we can refer to the, you know, the guidelines for public comment. That would be a suggestion.
I would also comment that when I was trying to gather what practices are followed by the other agencies, in a couple of the districts, they require all speakers to fill the... We've been very open about allowing people to come forward after you read through the submitted forms and opening it to the floor, and other agencies do not allow that. They require those forms to be submitted at the beginning of the meeting, and if you didn't fill out a form, you don't get to speak. So I think we're much more open to the public in that regard.
I would just support the timer and the consistency issue, and I think using, you know, the way Mark worded it was perhaps something the public could really understand, that if you go over your time, you're going to prevent someone later on the ability to speak, but then it's also our job to say, we mean it. You know, you're done. Your 3 minutes are up. And, you know, when people say, I just want to wrap up or I just want to finish, we've had times when the wrapping up has taken as long as the, you know, or taken quite a bit of time. And to reiterate that you're just pushing, you're preventing others from the opportunity to express their views and address the board would be perhaps helpful.
I'm going to go. I think the comments have all been good. I just want to point out that our current request or our current protocol is that the responsibility is vested in the president and the clerk to make a determination of that, of whether or not we're going to hold the time limits. And I think that's a good approach, but I'd also point out that the other board members could, by way of motion, move that even if the clerk and the president decide to impose time limits, that those time limits be waived. So at the meeting of February 9th, be more rigorous and adhering to our rules, and when we don't, that we make it clear that we are waiving them and suspending them for the reasons that we are. And I'd also just point out that it's awfully hard to regulate good manners. That's either going to be an organic thing or it's not. It was really uncomfortable to be put in a place where Jim or I would have to really get kind of verbally forceful to ask somebody to yield. I think we do the best we can. We hope for cooperation and courtesy from the public and respect for the other members of the public who would like to be heard. That has been the case in 99% of the meetings that I've been involved in over the years. So I support maintaining the policy and approach that we have now. I love the clock idea. I think it's really essential to the speaker that they have some idea that they're running out of time, especially after going through mock trial competition this time. And the students really have a... it's hard for them. In mock trial, if you run out of time, you have to stop talking. So I support keeping this approach in place. I like the clock idea, and I think we just need to be more consistent with how we approach public comment, notify the public of our approach, and follow it. Chris? And Mark?
I just want to check with Kim. My understanding of the material you gave us is that we would reach the end of 20 minutes, then it would come to the board
to make a decision, to the board to make a decision whether to extend it. And I thought that's what I read. I may have that.
Materials, that's what has been mentioned in your conversation tonight.
Okay, I thought it was. That's great. Okay.
Actually, I'm perfectly cool with the clerk and the president making that decision, knowing that the board can decide something different if they want to. The other thing I was going to say, though, is that if we truly decide we want to limit comments to a certain time period, I think one thing we ought to noodle is how do we decide in a fair way who gets to speak during that 20 minutes and who doesn't? So I don't know. You know, I don't have any ideas. Do we draw straws? Do we make it a lottery? First come, first serve?
Only people turn in the
form. Something so that it's fair for folks. And they don't say, you chose him, not me. You know, he ran up there before I did. So that would be my only suggestion.
Again, you've said it several times already. It is a rare circumstance that we have more people than we can accommodate in 20 minutes.
Right, but we had a lot of folks last year, and I suspect we're going to have a lot of folks for several meetings this year as well.
So, just towards Chris's comment, and you know, this can be an ongoing discussion or done through. I remember last year we had a couple of times where we had a stack of paper, we had 20 minutes, as I understand the code again, we have the ability to make it less than 3 minutes. So it's probably math beyond me, but you know, if you've got. Yeah. You got 20 slips, you're down to a minute apiece.
And we have done that previously. And three minutes is a discretionary time as well.
Okay.
That's not prescribed in code. That was the time that the board chose,
right.
which is commonly accepted.
And again, I think that's out of respect. It's just our respect for the public. If there's 20 people who want to speak, then it's got to be down to a minute apiece.
And how, if we never get to a point where we can discuss things at a reasonable hour, that's not doing the public any favors either.
Okay. So we leave it to staff to figure out the clock issue. There's got to be some off the air game show that doesn't need their clock anymore or something.
So
and so it's the consensus of the board that we continue our policies as is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right. Okay. Excellent. We will move on to approval of action consent items. Please let me know ones that you would like pulled. 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.02, acceptance of donations. 10.03, approval of purchase orders. 10.04, approval of warrants and payroll. And before we move to action on this, I meant to thank Mrs. Holmes for surfacing this issue and her excellent research on what other districts do. It helped a great deal.
I'll move approval of 10.01 to 10.04.
A motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer to approve items 10.01 through 10.04. Any discussion by the board? Did we go to the public for public comment? Further lights. Why don't we? Oh, Dr. Prater.
Yeah, the special meeting.
Oh.
Are we planning on meeting again next week, next Tuesday?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. We'll be adjourned.
Okay. Thanks.